calling from the bank. On a lighter note. Thank you very much. I'm going to hand over to the Minister for the introduction.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to members of the committee, and also welcome to members of the Gambling Board and the staff. We are on Bill 3, page 79 of the main documents. I am tabling before this committee the main appropriation of 352.390 million for this year, and for next year I'm tabling a budget of 343 million and for the outer year 3.59392 million. But before I go into the greater detail through my HOD, I would first also, Chair, I would like to take this opportunity to congratulate Mr. Lekay. We have extended through the Cabinet and through this work of this committee the appointment of Mr. Lekay as a member of the board, and I am pleased that the Cabinet has approved it last week, and that we have also I have appointed him to take up the position of chairperson of the Western Cape Gambling and Racing Board, and I want to thank him for taking up this huge responsibility, because this is a 500 million rand responsibility. It's half a billion of tax that we collect. We are particularly happy that he is fit for purpose, and we want to thank him for his specific skills that he's bringing. His specific area of skills is in this area of tax collection, and the Western Cape Gambling and Racing Board is in the tax business, and I'm very pleased to see that the Gambling Board is in good hands within the context of domestic resource mobilization. Chair, I think there are maybe four issues that I would like to bring to the attention of the committee. Firstly, the issue that will still impact on the budget of this department is the whole issue of the wage negotiations that is still currently the three-year wage negotiation agreement has come to an end, and we are now negotiating a new agreement, and that will impact on the wage and salary bill of the government. That's the first one. The second one relates to the inflation on goods and services for this financial year. The third one has to do with VAT. We have also seen that VAT has been increased from 14% to 15%, so there is a 1% implication for the budget. And the last matter is maybe we'll see some underspending when we come to that financial performance of the Treasury at the later stage, and another format. This is one of the first meetings where we don't have a CFO. As you all remember, the CFO has retired, and that's why our acting CFO is here present today. So that's all from me, Chairperson, except to say that there are some further work that we need to do within the gambling space, but we are now first dealing with this vote. And when it comes to the Gambling Board, I think they will certainly indicate what those specific areas are. I think I'm going to leave it here, Chair, and then immediately hand back to you.
Thank you. HOD, any follow-up on the Minister's forward?
No, Chairperson, thank you very much. Maybe just a couple of things. Maybe just for the committee to note, there are a couple of apologies from the Provincial Treasury's usual top management that's represented here. We have a CFO forum out of town today, and then also a couple of people on leave, so there are, but all the programs are adequately represented here. Chairperson, I think maybe just to latch on to a couple of things that Minister Meyer has said in his introductory comments. As the committee would know, we are now in our fourth year of our strategic plan 2015-2020, and I mean, we are still then in pursuit of our vision of good financial governance. I can confirm, Chair, that at this point in time, I mean, we have done the alignment checks with the between our APP and the various key legislative documents and also the national planning instruments. Minister has indicated, I mean, there's a budget in this year of 325 million. And the budget composition just broadly is 59%, or just under 60% of the budget goes towards compensation. And I think that is the point that Minister made in relation to the impact of the wage negotiations, and then about 18% goods and services, and then the balance more or less towards transfer payments. Chair, I think just, not to repeat, but I mean, there are a number of challenges that we face as a vote, I mean, as a government. I mean, despite that, we are still committed to work with our partners towards working towards achieving our objectives as per our PSP. Chair, I'll now hand back to yourself, and then we will take questions from the committee. Thanks.
Thank you, members. Any questions on the introductions of the Minister and HOD? Member McKenzie and Member Ace?
Thank you, Chair. If they can perhaps just share with us how fast the process with regards to the acting CFO. And then secondly, I've also noticed on your, there's a DDG governance and asset management that's vacant. I can't remember, this is the first time I've asked you before, apologies, how fast that process was regarding the appointment of the DDG. And then with regards to the process on the wage negotiations, just Minister, how far is that process as well? If you can just give us some more information. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Member Ash. Member Bevan, goes to follow.
Thank you, Chairperson. Also on the wage negotiations, I would like to ask, what is the amount that was made available in the budget for wage increases? Is it the 8.4 or something like that percentage? So just to understand, what is the amount that you budgeted for? And just to explain to us the process, if there's a negotiated agreement, what is the percentage that will come from national government, and what would be the extent of yourself carrying some percentage of the increase? The second question, Chairperson, is water. There's a lot said about water and more across all the departments. I would like to ask, what are you as a department doing specifically in terms of water in the department itself? What measures did you take? What savings did occur there? Thirdly, Chairperson, it's the one on VAT. I think that you maybe you must tell us, did you budget for that 1 percentage point increase in VAT? Can we also understand what is the total VAT amount that is within the total budget of provincial government and provincial parliament per annum? And what would be that 1 percentage point increase be, and how would you finance that 1% increase to have that money available? Thank you.
Thank you, Member Bielanko.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to know whether the rest of the people on this organogram on page 18, are they all at this workshop as was explained, or is there another reason why some of them are not here? Because I'm trying to understand up to which level have you invited officials to be here today. That's the one question. My other question, as we carry on, Chairperson, it would be remiss of me, after having had the honour and opportunity to be invited to Commonwealth programs for Africa, Commonwealth programs internationally via Vote 2's expenditure. So as you go along, I'd like to know what this vote is putting aside for implementation to empower women specifically. Because we cannot be attending these things and we come back and we don't implement. So I'd like to know where that will be in this specific program. And then, of course, the Chairperson, you know what my issue is always with these budgets and different programs, is that it's presented to us and all we can do is question and raise our voices and get upset and want to influence, but we cannot change anything. And MEC, up to this stage, we still don't know where that legislation is and why it's being held up. I think the last time you said it was somewhere, or the Chairperson said it was somewhere at the speakers forum or something, we've requested feedback on that. It hasn't yet got here, so we're still at this frustrating stage of just accepting what's in front of us, questioning it, but not being able to influence a change at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Bevenko. And the last one I will answer is that the Deputy Speaker has wrote to us. I received a letter from the Deputy Speaker because, remember, we've said at the budget meeting the Speaker's Forum National will deal with that. So in this week we have received a letter from the Deputy Speaker, which I will table at the budget meeting. So that point is covered. Thank you. Over to the Minister and the HOD. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to Honourable Member McKenzie, Honourable Member Ace and Bielanko for these questions. Some of these questions will be answered by the department. But in the context of the national negotiations, which is currently still a process, we have seen that the national minister, or the previous national minister of finance, has in his main budget made provision for 110 billion rand for the wage negotiations. at the last meeting, there was an additional request for 9 billion countrywide to be divided amongst the national and provincial government departments. The current wage bill demand from the unions on the table is currently about 300 billion rand. You will note that the total government wage bill is currently 580 billion. I'm very happy that all members of the wage negotiating mandate committee confirmed that this is unsustainable and unaffordable if we want to proceed with this modeling of the wage bill. The National Treasury has also made a presentation that countries similar to us, in terms of the various indicators, has indicated that we need a wage bill of about 350 billion rand, and we are already standing at 580 billion rand countrywide. So I'm particularly happy that those discussions are now still in place. There are now some specific mandates which the negotiating committee has given, and because it is still in the sensitive stage of negotiations with the various unions, I think it is inappropriate for me to communicate those figures right here in this meeting, except to say that we are currently making progress. And the question specifically from Member Ace was, what is the total VAT in the whole of the government in terms of all the programs, and the officials can maybe answer that. Zak and them will also answer the issue of the officials and the organogram. And I think the colleagues will also answer the question relating to the empowerment for women specifically. And I'm very happy, Chair, that you have already answered the question about the oversight budget legislation from the letter that you've received from the Deputy Speaker. And may I also request a copy of that particular letter. And as I have said in the past, that those letters, those are a process that I respect within the legislative arm of government, and I'm also very looking forward to that. But while that is a process, Honourable Member Beerbunker will know that my attitude is that I respect all inputs from this committee. We have in the past changed our minds as a result of this input. So it is technically incorrect to say nothing can change. As a result of the work that this committee has done in the past, I have changed my mind. And if there are anything substantively based on evidence and we can have a conversation about it, I'm quite happy to change my mind. And this does not mean there's no place and space for a Standing Committee of Finance. This is the most important committee in this government, and I have indicated to you in Parliament to what extent I have listened to this committee. So I appreciate this work, and I therefore do not see that this is a waste of time. I see this is a very important part of the whole process of budget formulation, budget implementation, and budget evaluation. So I respect the work of this committee. Thank you, Chair.
Over the HOD, members, I will give you a chance. Let me just...
I might just forget. I'm at that stage where I forget.
You want to talk on this? On your last point.
I'm being honest.
On the last point.
Yes,
okay,
Chair.
Fine.
MEC, maybe I should rephrase what I just said. Currently, we're not able to change anything as we're looking at it here. I also, at the end of last year, mentioned that there's legislation out, or it was a Treasury note, to say that we are allowed to amend only if it's less than 8%. So I accept that we are allowed to change, but that's going forward. You are allowed to change and make recommendations for 8% and not more. But with this budget as it stands, there's nothing that we can do now. That's what I'm actually saying. I do realize that there are opportunities going forward.
Thank you. Just switch your mic off, please. Member Beerbunker, thank you very much. I'm handing over to the... Yeah. The matter actually sits with the budget committee at the moment, so I do not want us to, you know, start to debate here, but I know it will impact on Treasury and other departments as well. Over to the HOD. Thank you.
Okay. Now, Chairperson, thanks very much for all the questions. I mean, I'm going to touch on a couple of them. I'm going to ask Mr. Malila to talk about some of the VAT stuff, and then I'll ask Ms. Smith to talk about the initiatives that we deal with, that we're busy dealing with, we have underway in terms of the women in a woman program. And then, Chair, maybe just to then kick off with the first round responses. Chair, I mean, it's customary for us to present our documents here at this committee and be represented by our top management committee. So, I mean, not all the members typically of the senior management cadre would be in attendance here. I mean, there are different reasons. I mean, two of the members are off sick at the moment. And then also there are representatives here from the program. So Mr. Reddy is here for program 4. And and I think Mr. Malela will cover, so Ms. Pick is here for on behalf of Ms. Cantana. So, Chair, I mean, I can also confirm Mr. Deakala, who's the acting chief director. I mean, he is out chairing the CFO forum, and there's also a national PAG forum. So, I mean, we have to divide forces. I mean, that is unfortunately the reality. There are various commitments that we have to spread ourselves across. Chair, with just a general comment on the status of the vacancies, I mean, we've got an approved funded vacancy list, and all of those posts that have been funded are underway. If a committee wants us to provide us, if a committee would like us to provide them with a list of it, we can surely do so. I think we've done that on a previous occasion as well, but we can definitely provide that again. I'm going to pause then. I'm going to just ask the rest of my colleagues to assist with the balance of the questions. Thanks.
Chair, thank you very much. And just a question on the VAT. I think what we've done, given the fact that we've highlighted in the budget, we've highlighted the risk of the 1 percentage point increase. Now, if one look at the entire budget of government, it's about 62 billion. The only portion that we believe doesn't attract VAT at this point in time is the salary bill. Obviously, there's no salary, so there's about 30 billion that we believe will be subjected to this 1 percentage point increase, and that's about 300 million more or less per annum. So that's effectively what the current services will cost in the new year, or what it will cost by just adding a 1 percentage point to the bill. Obviously, there's been no compensation for that, and there's been no compensation to anybody in government to deal with that. So it's something that we will have to take into account, you know, when we spend, and that's also been communicated to all departments, and it's effective. Well, the proposal at the moment from National Parliament is that be effective from the 1st of April. I think that was.
I'm going to respond to two questions, and the one is the water and what are we measures are we implementing within the department. I think for us it's changing the behaviour and doing the basics right. For example, ensuring that all the lights are switched off when we leave the offices, all the taps are closed, and the Department of Transport and Public Works also install the taps that you press and not that you turn, so it goes off after a few seconds, so people can't leave the taps open, it closes automatically. And we've also, there's a number of awareness campaigns, posters, that is placed on the desks and within on strategic positions. And then we also use our information sharing platforms, for example, our PT communication, our PT blog, and also in various meetings we emphasize the responsible use of the resources, for example, water and electricity.
If I may just add, I mean, maybe just from a business continuity perspective, I mean, every department is required to have a business continuity plan. What we have done over the last couple of months is revisit our business continuity plan to check its suitability to respond to the drought crisis. And we've gone through extensive revision process, and that process was generally coordinated by Mr. Code or Advocate Code from the Department of Transport and Public Works, whose overall responsibility was to just make sure that there is cohesion between all the requirements of the different departments and to ensure that there is facilities available should there be no water in some of the government buildings. So, I mean, we have gone through a process, and we've even gone so far as to understand what would be the impact on the business. And, I mean, our disaster recovery plan would unpack how we'd respond, who would be called to duty depending on what time of the year it is. And then we've also initiated call 3 tests to make sure that we've got a process in place to communicate with all the staff in the event of a disaster. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you. Members, are you covered? Member McKenzie,
thank
Member
you, perhaps I'm asking my question differently. But when do you think the CFO, the DDG Governance and Asset Management, CFO, HOD? Okay. But when do you think the CFO, the Chief Director of Local Government Finance, the DDG Governance, and the Director of Financial Governance will be appointed?
The CFO post we expect to go to Cabinet in the next month, within the next month for support. Then within the Chief Director, Local Government, Public Finance, I can just ask Mr. Malela just to talk to that one. The DDG process has just recently started, so that one will probably take another 4 to 5 months. And then the Director of Financial Governance, the shortlist has been approved, so interviews will commence within the next couple of weeks.
Chair, the plan is to advertise the Chief Director of Public Finance Local Government within the next month. I mean, we've gone through all the OD processes already, because there are standard TPSA processes if certain posts have not been re-evaluated, so that has taken a little bit of time.
Thank you, Member.
Chairperson, the first one on the vacancies, I think it would be good if we can get a full table of post filled, those not filled, and whenever you're going to fill that. Second one, Chairperson, I think it's important not to only look at the department and the tax, but important the business continuity plan, and I think there must be a special presentation to this standing committee, because they play a very important transversal role throughout all the departments, and if there's a problem with your IT systems or whatever systems, it could be a major problem, even your service that you render to local government. So I would like to see in your business continuity plan how you also help and support local government, apart from only, and of course, provincial government in that. So I think that's very important that as soon as possible we get hold of that. Then thirdly, Chairperson, it's that 300 million rand VAT, but I didn't hear how it's going to be funded. You said there's no provision for it from national, so the provision must come within the departments. And I would like to ask, are you going to use some of the savings or money that you've put aside in reserves, or must each department now save that 300 million rand or their portion of the 300 million rand? I think it's important, and I also think it's important for you to give direction to departments and not wait for a month or three and then you get down the line and then there's major problems. So I think it's important that we do that. The question that I've asked on the salaries and the negotiations around that is, because you also referred in your document, but I'm linking it now to what the Minister said, Chairperson, and that was on page 90, and I'm not jumping the pages, but just to refer what the Minister referred to, and that's the 8.4% that I quoted there, because that's the one that you are working on, or the assumption that you've taken on that. You even have a projection for the next and the next financial year, creating the impression there's a new cycle and it's been finalized already. And my question is really, will all money, whatever the agreement is at national, come from national government to fund if any shortfall might occur in terms of the outcome of the negotiations? And I want to understand the risk for this provincial government and for your department in terms of wage negotiations. So often we heard from the MEC that one of the big challenges and even threats is the high package of salary that must be paid, and that's the question in that perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Ash. Over to the Minister and the HOD.
I think these are real big risks, the issue of the VAT. And just to give an indication to Honourable Member Ace, we did think about this, and we did do some preliminary calculations. Only for the Department of Health, a 1% VAT increase will have a 183 million rand impact on the health budget. But they have no money. What this will mean, we will have to close places or take people are already sleeping on the floor of hospitals because there are no bed space as a result of this. So I think this will have real severe implications for particularly those big service delivery departments, because they procure food, nutrition, after-school children, our ECD centers, our child youth care centers, specifically those children in conflict with the law. They stay at child youth care centers where they need to buy food. Has massive implications for those particular budgets. I think the colleagues will answer, and the wage negotiations is the same. And I think we need to have a conversation, because when we had this conversation within the executive wage negotiated mandating committee, they excluded in this conversation wages and salaries for public entities. Now we know what this is situation with public entities nationally. They are not included in this wage negotiations. So there's a risk if we're not including wage negotiations of public entities, and they carry on like Eskom and all of these entities, and they get 10, 20, 30% salary increases and million rands of bonuses, that also has a massive impact on the wage negotiations. And I think maybe Harry can just refer to the question that you specifically asked about page 89. But I think what I have seen in the figures of the main budget was that there is provision made in that budget for allocations to all the provinces and to the national departments to the tune of 110 billion rand.
Antena, thank you for the question. Maybe just on the salary stuff. I mean, the members are aware that the wage negotiations normally runs a process of about 3 years. And in most of these processes, you would either get inflation, and then it always be inflation plus something. In this case, it's inflation plus one, but there's also a component that's part of the, let's call it salary negotiations, that deals with pay progression. So all departments have to budget for 8.4%, which includes 2%, maximum of 2% pay progression. So it's effectively 6.4%, so that would amount to inflation plus one, and then obviously the 2 percentage points for pay progression, that's in the budgeting system. And then what we've done is that as part of the budgeting process, National Treasury would also provide us with inflation indicators or wage indicators, and the estimates that's in the budget for now is 8.5% and 8.5% in the middle and in the last year. So we're effectively saying if the wage negotiations come out 6.4% and in the middle year 6.5% and 6.5% in the last year, no department should have a problem. The risk that we have is that some of the proposals that's on the table now, obviously as ministers indicated, far outstrips just the normal inflationary adjustments. That's not even to talk about some of the other things that's added on, like additional housing, additional medical subsidy, maybe some commuted overtime allowances, etc., which all adds to the wage bill. And that is the risk at the moment. We, given the fact that the wage negotiations are currently in a sensitive stage, as the Minister has indicated, there are various discussions that takes place between the DPSA, the various provincial government departments, and also the unions to somehow try and, you know, come to an agreement that would obviously, you know, best suit all the parties. But all indicators are that there's a high probability that the outcome of the wage agreement at this point in time would outstrip what's already been provided for in the budget. We didn't budget for any difference in that in the 2018-2019 year. However, what we've done, and when we presented to the budget committee, we have set aside funding in the middle and in the last year under the ICS reserve, and that is on page Roman 2 of the big budget. If the members can recall the presentation that we've made, of about 700 million and more or less double that in the last year, to deal with the possible implications of the wage negotiation process outcome. At this point in time, it's unknown. In our discussions even with National Treasury, they haven't put anything on the table, and we will only be able to deal with that when we actually get to the adjustments estimate. So that is why we've pulled it into our fiscal risk statement. Because obviously once those agreements are signed, nobody can walk away from it, and we just need to pick up the tab, obviously, for that. Just on the VAT issue, because I think that's also something that is linked. All of that, Chair, is part of our fiscal consolidation measure. So there's no additional funding that has come, and we've actually asked departments over and above those reductions that's already been introduced because of the cuts that's been made nationally as part of the national fiscal consolidation strategy. In addition to that, they should also provide for the implications of the additional VAT, because obviously they won't be able to escape it as such and just pay for it. What we're doing as a Treasury, and I mean I've already had discussions with Mr. Smith, I don't think one should actually just regard this 1 percentage point increase as something likely. It will have major implications for departments because there are currently contracts that are running. That's, as an example, in place. We might have concluded those contracts 2-3 years ago with certain taxation implications. So it means that our supply chain team, together obviously with legal services, will have to assist the departments to go and look and interrogate those contracts. And if those contracts provided that government should pick up any related tax increases, then it effectively means that the contract price will increase by the 1 percentage point that's currently on the table. I think it will also provide a lesson, you know, for governments generally how to deal with the stuff in terms of contract management. But generally, most contracts, the contractor would actually say that they cannot pick up the tab for any VAT, or let's call it any taxation increases per se, because that is outside of their normal scope. So that's the work that we're planning to do, and as I've indicated, I've already spoken to Isaac as the acting DDG in Program 3 and 4, given that supply chain sits under him, that we just get a handle on some of these contracts. In addition to that, we might even get requirements from outside parties who is delivering services on our behalf, like the NGOs and some of the people sitting in other sectors that are delivering services to government, and even those ones that we're making transfer payments to that are delivering stuff on us, where they're going to come back and say, you know, that the government needs to compensate for the additional increases. So, Chair, I think we would probably be in a better position maybe around June or so, you know, to maybe some proper quantification, you know, once we've actually gone through each of the departments to assess the implications of the VAT and to what extent departments have been able to pick that up.
Thank you very much, Minister, HOD officials. Member Tessis, you have something that you want to clear or you covered? I will you. Okay, fine, well, when we do the pages. We can start with page 79. Page 80, page 79, Member Bevan. Thank you.
No, Chair. Actually, before we even go to page 79, I'm glad that there was this transversal discussion about Treasury's role across different departments and how important it is that you have a handle on what's going on all over the show. So if you would allow me, Chair, I just want to go back to the Roman numeral pages and ask some questions there, just for clarity going forward. My first question is on page, and possibly the response to this question will be, I'll get from the Gambling Board, but I just want the background to this one. It's on Roman numeral 6. And all I'm asking there is the reason for the decrease in own receipts the fact that LPM machines are not being as lucrative as they were or should be? Is that the main reason? And if so, I'll get it from the others. Then on page 6, the lower part, summary of the provincial payments, also the margin of decrease in vote 8 and specifically vote 14, not so much vote 11, what would be the reason for that? On page 6, Roman numeral, what exactly is land and subsoil assets? That's part of your payments that I'm talking about, because these are all things that need to go out. There's a decrease in that payment anyway. It was 32 million before, it's now 7 million. I don't know why I didn't ask the question before, but I picked it up now. And then, check on page 9. What is the difference between a provincial government business enterprise and a Western Cape public entity? Latch onto that. this discrepancy between vote 11 and the AG and the fact that there's a dispute between them about what is transfer payment and what's goods and services. Now, part of the response is that National Treasury is supposed to give guidelines and give them the final answer and all that sort of thing. The AG has an idea and he has expressed his finding on what a transfer payment is and what goods and services is. So I'd like to know what Treasury's role is in all of that. Were you part of these negotiations? What is your idea? Where do you stand on this issue? And do you agree with the department or do you agree with the Auditor General? And if so, why? Right at the top, under National Public Entities, you've got CETA, and there's an exorbitant amount that gets paid to the CETA. And possibly education would be able to give that answer, but because of your connection and involvement, you might be able to tell me what do they get in return for all of that money that they pay. On page 11, you only allocated in the outer years money for fire service capacity building grant. When last did you allocate for that service? And then, of course, my question was, I was trying to find where the women are in all of this, and I still haven't heard the response to that. That's for now, Chet, so that I can just get an overall picture of what's going on here.
Thank you. Over to the Minister and the HOD.
Chair, I think what we have before us is vote 3, and I would prefer that we also spend most of the time on vote 3, but it does not include some of these questions that the honourable member asked, because the question was what is the other roles and responsibilities of the provincial treasury. Obviously, some of those questions I think are more specifically also directed at those specific votes of that department, but we are happy to answer some of these specific questions also as it relates to the roles and responsibilities of the provincial treasury. Over to the HOD.
Chairperson, what we'll do is, I mean, we'll try and assist with some of those questions right now. I'll ask Mr. Molina just to talk about the revenue and Ms. Speak just to talk about some of those expenditure trends between those two votes. And then Mr. Reddy, just to pick up on maybe the AG stuff, and I'll add to it if necessary. Thanks.
Chair, we have extensively written about the revenue stuff in, again, the budget overview document, and that's mainly on page 90 and page 91 of those documents, and it goes up until page 92. The major adjustments, obviously, given some of the downward adjustments, and I'll just deal with some of the key departments, is just an example in the Department of Health, and there are particular reasons, and that relates to the current donor funding agreement relating to the Global Fund coming to an end in 2018-2019. So what the members would see is that the out-year estimates is more or less equal to the 2018-19 estimates, and there's just a normal inflationary increase in that. Some of the other issues are really small adjustments, and in fact, sometimes the adjustment percentage-wise speak, but it's actually from a small base. And human settlements, it's relating to some of the transfers, you know, that would either come back to the department, and they've only estimated 60 million in the first year. But year on year, Chair, on receipts, there is an inflationary increase of about 5%, more exactly it's 5.02, and it runs through the various departments, and particularly in Treasury, and most of that obviously relates to the Gambling Board, there's an adjustment of 8.2%, and it partially provides for an increase in the own revenue as a result of casino taxation, and most of the other tax collections, particularly relating to certain industries like LPM and horse racing, that more or less remains flat, but I mean, we can give some further detail to that. And then, I mean, analysts will talk to, I think, that issue around the land and the subsoil issues. And then just the key point, Ms. Berenkamp, that you ask around human settlement and local government. Human settlements is mainly as a result of the reduction in the human settlements conditional grant that we've indicated. I think it's something like 300 an odd million rand. And then obviously the reduction in local government is as almost exclusively as a result of the adjusted estimates amount. You, Ms. Berenkamp, will see that the main appropriation previously was 249. Then the adjusted estimates was 359, and that's mainly because of the drought allocation of about 85 million or so. And then the new allocation is 252. So if one just look at year on year, there's an increase from 249 to 252 if one discount what has happened in the adjusted estimates. And then the human settlement is in the main because of the obviously the grant allocation. There's 100 million. Remember, that's now in the third or additional adjusted estimates, as we call it. Okay. And then there's, that is also coupled with the reduction of about 300 odd million in the conditional grant for that vote. And then the last issue is just the table that you referred to on the fire issues. I think it was Roman 9, if I'm not wrong. Roman 11. Roman 7, yeah, analysts will respond to the issue around land and subsoil assets that you've asked for. That's in Roman 7. And then Roman 11 is the issue around the fire capacity. That table deals with the amount that's not as yet allocated. So what it means in 18-19, they've already allocated fire money, and in fact, we have earmarked the fire allocation in the Department of Local Government, so they cannot shift that money anywhere. So if you look at their vote particularly and the appropriation bill, you will see that the money has been allocated, and the outer year money will be allocated on an annual basis given the risk that they undertake during during the year. I think that's more or less from our side. Thank you.
Land and subsoil, the expenditure that is recorded under that particular item is all expenditure that involves in terms of the procuring of land. So you'll find in terms of the amount, in terms of a specific vote, that you'll find in transport and public works in terms of the budgeting thereof. Well, the entire item member is in terms of land and in terms of subsoil. So in terms of subsoil, there's in terms of various, in terms of pieces of land, in terms of various soil that departments could purchase. And that is in terms of, if I remember correctly, under road infrastructure, in terms of certain of the, road infrastructure that is required. But it's in terms of, mostly for this province, it is in terms of the purchasing of land and the, all the costs related thereto.
Sorry, Chair. I mean, in response to the Government Business Enterprise Act, there are categories of public entities, and if you look at the PFMA, they got 3D, 3C, and 3C and D. And I think the government business enterprise is a 3D. So government enterprise is a 3D, and public entity, and the 3C is normal public entity.
Question, what does it mean? Thank you for the response, but I want to know, what does it mean?
Chair, the major difference is that your 3D entities is almost a quasi kind of entity that runs like a company, a business. So in fact, they're dependent on government, but not entirely dependent, whilst a public entity, in terms of the definition, there's a substantial part of that that is dependent on government. On transfer payments, there's also obviously some issues around the relationship with the parent department, and then there are also issues around accountability. That is particularly different between a 3C and a 3D. So the Gambling Board, as an example, would be a 3C entity that's got accountability arrangements directly with the minister via the accounting officer to the legislature, whilst a 3D entity runs almost like a company with limited oversight responsibilities from the accounting officer of the parent company. That's in essence, in simplistic terms, if I can explain it, but the accountability arrangements is fundamentally different.
Also, Chair, in the context of public entities here in the Western Cape, when we issue budget circulars to the various departments, we also issue those budget circulars to the various public entities. For example, if there are salary increases, we guide them in terms of the salary increases for public entities. We cannot have a situation that public entities have massive increases and the department is on a different level. So we guide them in terms of what is the sort of corporate governance architecture for the management, because we have adopted a good financial governance architecture, and we also ask the public entities here in the Western Cape to be under the same sort of corporate governance architecture in that particular regard. And we've also put some ceilings in terms of the COE levels with regard to public entities. But there was also a question relating to Honourable Member Beerwinkel in relation to the issue of the SCOPA and the Auditor General, and whether the question was quite direct. Whether we support the department. Absolutely, we support the Department of Agriculture because, and you also asked for the reason. In fact, last year, it was a transfer payment, and the Auditor General gave us a clean audit. Now, what has changed so dramatically that the Auditor General now wants to use a different definition for a transfer payment and qualify it as a goods and services? We do not agree with the Auditor General that it is goods and services. It is transfer payment. There are many other departments that also have transfer payments. It is not goods and services. So we will certainly first explore all our internal opportunities. And we have written to the Auditor General. And the Auditor General has now asked the National Treasury for a particular view. Our view is clear. This is not goods and services. This is not procurement. This is a transfer payment. And I think the Auditor General is at risk. And we're not in the business of threatening the Auditor General, because it is a supreme auditing institution in South Africa, and their purpose in life is to make sure that we have good corporate governance. So we respect the independence of the Auditor General, but we have a different view, and we're prepared to deal with the Auditor General in a collegial, professional and ethical manner on this matter.
Chief, I may just add, I mean, as the Minister has indicated, I mean, we've been involved with this matter since about July last year. And in fact, I think the department actually made a presentation to their standing committee as it yesterday. But because the question is asked, I mean, and the minister's answered, have we taken a view on it? I mean, Minister is correct. We have taken a view. We have analysed the evidence submitted by the Department of Agriculture, and we also looked at the issues that the Auditor General raised in the draft management report. And between the PAG functionaries within the provincial treasury, I mean, we've looked at this stuff, and we've actually engaged on various occasions the Auditor General on the interpretation. I mean, the last formal engagement that we had with the Auditor General, I mean, facilitated a discussion between the Agriculture Department as well as the Auditor General, and then also colleagues from the National Treasury. And that meeting took place, Johnson, in about November last year. Unfortunately, Chair, I think we're still waiting for National Treasury and the National Auditor General to apply their mind to this issue. I know it is being discussed, in fact, at the PAG forum that Mr. Brindis is at today. What I think I should add, I mean, it's not unusual for any department to have a difference of opinion with the Auditor General, and I mean, these things happen almost every year. What is different this time around is that the extension of this thing, we normally get the differences resolved before the audit reports are due. And I think it's a bit unfortunate that we've not been able to get the necessary pronouncement on this issue. And one of the key issues that we raise, as Mr. Beerwinkel raised, is, you know, we've now put the budget together, and this budget is based on the existing system that we've previously adopted for many years, that the transfer payment is a transfer payment, and these goods and services have got a different connotation to it. And I mean, I've also raised a particular issue with the National Treasury and with the Accountant General's office, and I've asked them to particularly engage the budget office at the National Treasury to make sure that there isn't an unintended consequence with regards to how this issue is interpreted because of technical issues. But Chair, if you want any further information, there's lots of correspondences, and we can provide the committee with that. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for the response, the questions, and for the response. We move to page 80. Member H.
Chairperson, demands and changes in services or in service. You referred to the 10.8 million rand there and the allocation to municipalities for bursaries. Just to, number one, understand whether you have all municipalities on board now. And secondly, one of the requirements has been in the past that there must be a commitment from the municipality for co-funding. Now, did you get that commitment for co-funding? And is the co-funding 50-50, or did you water it down? Even if they give 10 rand or 100 rand, you still will consider that as a commitment towards co-funding. That, of course, is defeating the purpose of this whole thing, this grant, and I would like to understand to what extent did you compromise and yourself to an extent the principle and just move forward. And then specifically Swellendam, if I can recall, was one of the municipalities that did not commit themselves, and where do we stand with that? There's 360,000 rand chairperson per annum, and I think it's quite difficult to administer this because they must now recruit people and have a memorandum of understanding with the department. But let's say that's fine. Let us just get an understanding and maybe one step back. What happened last year? What was the successes that you experienced of people? I know we're in the beginning of this cycle, but did you experience any successes already with students so appointed? I know it's a 3-year degree or a diploma that they must follow. So if you can just elaborate on that, please. Thank you.
Member H, thank you. I think you took a big risk in mentioning Member Beerwinkel's constituents is sharing them. No, I picked up the like that. Thank you. Over to the department.
Chena, Member S is correct. I mean, we had some challenges last year with regards to two municipalities. I mean, I can confirm that those municipalities have come to party. So, I mean, I think I must also thank the committee. And I think Member Beerwinkel, you asked the question, you know, what is the role that you play? I mean, you guys have helped us. I mean, I must say that was the influence that you exercised over that. It helped us definitely with getting some buy-in on the other side. So thank you very much for that. Chair, I think it is a bit early to talk about the successes. I know in my engagements with some of the municipal managers, they have, when we launched the program, they were quite excited. Remember, we initiated this program because of capacity shortages within the municipal area. So they were quite excited. Many of them actually came up and were quite elated at the prospects of having to get people sponsored and also then work back at those particular municipalities. Chair, the issue around the co-funding, I'm going to ask Mr. Meletis just to talk about it. I mean, we've been explicit with municipalities not to be frivolous about their co-contribution. Mr. Meletis?
No, thank you, Chair. No, the first thing that I think we need to put on the table is that this grant is typically a grant in aid. Okay? So we have engaged with the various municipalities, and in fact, we've also taken into account the distance that they are from some of your major institutions. So most of the municipalities have either given money as a co-contribution or have given the commitment to support the students in kind. So it's an example, supporting them with traveling, particularly when they come maybe from your towns that are far out, traveling, particularly from your CKD region and also from your Eden towns. We can provide the committee with a list of, you know, the co-funding that's been provided by the municipality, but I think, as Zach has also indicated, a lot of this is also dependent on the municipality themselves and to what extent they show the seriousness, you know, with regards to this program. The other issue that I can also put on the table is that this year, I think it will be the first year that we're going to even deploy some of our own bursary interns. That's also a bursary program that we fund internally in the department, obviously in the various regions, at some of these municipalities. And we can also provide the committee with a list of those people that will go to the various municipalities. So outside of just sending them to departments, they've also now been deployed at the various municipalities. And obviously the grant that goes to municipalities, it's now in the second year. This is actually the second year, more or less, second study year. Or this is the third year, but in most cases like the second study year, of this deployment. But we keep on watching what is happening in the space, and we will can provide the committee with an updated report, particularly just on this financial management support grant.
I think for the record, as acting constituency head for Swellendam and member Bierwinkel, I think the officials are just confirming our oversight role and intervention and the results thereof. So well done to the committee for raising this these issues. Thank you. Page 81.
Just to be clear, we're going to get that report, but also on the co-funding. And did they commit, can I just ask the question then, did Swellendam commit to co-funding? And to what extent? I mean, you surely must know that, because you knew we're going to ask that question.
I am on the record, so I will rather have to check it and come back to the committee. Yeah.
We'll get that information as part of the report on the bigger question that we've asked. Page 81. Member Ace.
Thank you. I just want to ask the question around the third round of interns will be taken up by the CA Academy, and I would like to ask what is the progress in terms of that and any success around that program.
Thank you. Over to the department.
Chair, I can confirm, and Ms. Smith can maybe just clarify if I'm mistaken, but the third round of intake, I think we have to reduce the number of interns. I mean, just given the general pressure on the budget across the vote, so we had to reduce the number of interns and also the maximum number of interns that the CA manager is allowed to have in terms of the SAICA regulation is limited to about 15, if I'm correct. Anna-Marie?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the third round has been signed off in this week. I mean, we're taking on four additional CA interns this year, and they started on the 1st of March. In fact, that was this, on the 1st of March. Chair, with regards to successes, I mean, I stand to be corrected. I mean, there has been a couple of progressions in terms of passes, in terms of the academic requirements of that of those interns. I can also provide the committee with a list of who's progressed academically. But so far, we're on track in terms of producing our first round of CA interns next year. Thanks.
Thank you. I think for the record, I've asked the department also to invite the members to these award occasions to where they showcase the interns and the students that are making progress. Page 82, thank you.
Just one question. We're referring to the current financial year, 2017-18, and what is your expectation in terms of spending and underspending for this financial year? And did you already accommodate a possible rollover within the budget for 18-19?
Okay. Over to the department. Thank you.
Yeah. Can I ask Theo and Ursula to assist with that?
In terms of the spending on the current budget, there were some issues that we identified, especially in terms of COE, where positions actually had to fall into the 2018 financial year. And in terms of goods and services, we are actually making progress. There have been expenditures that have been identified where there were savings that were identified during the last since the adjustments period. And in terms of rollovers, there won't be any rollovers because we do not have any capital projects that need to be rolled over. Thank you.
What is the expected underspending for this financial year? Is a total amount of 287 million. What is the expected expenditure and expected underspending on the vote?
Chair, at the moment, it seems as if we will be able to be within the 2% variance. So I don't envision any problems in terms of underspending by over 2%. Thank you.
Maybe just to clarify, I mean, also add on to what Theo said, I mean, on this compensation budget, we're definitely going to land within the 2% transfers, should be fine. Just on the goods and services, there has been some challenges or delays with procurement, so we'll keep our eye on it, and I think if there's any deviation beyond the 2%, then we'll inform the committee about that. But we are trying our best to make sure we land within the 2% norm. Thanks.
Thank you. Page 83.
Chair, just on the training to national departments, just give us what training do you provide to national departments?
And then, sorry, member Ace?
Chairperson, also on page 83, just on the supplier development initiatives, and I picked up that was quite an initiative over the last year or two. If you can just tell us what is the objective of that specific supplier development initiative, and to what did you measure it, and what is the outcome or successes of that specific, can we call it roadshows or whatever you do?
Over to the department, thank you.
As you can ask yourself and Nadia just to talk about this.
Okay, I'll talk to the training and Nadia will respond on the supply development. As far as the national department is concerned, in the province, we're responsible for all training on the financial systems. And because we've got accredited training officials, what the National Treasury have requested us, if there are any national departments that's situated in the Western Cape, that they also attend our training. So that is happening on a continuous basis.
Thank you, Chair. Similarly, I think in the procurement environment, if there are any initiatives around the CSD or new implementation on the SCM reform, and if our national departments or entities want to tap into training initiatives that we have, then we invite them in to the process. So we have it all inclusive. That also includes supply development. We're dealing with objectives around commodities. So it's basically most of it is focused on procurement and how to do business with government. So in the last year, the key focus is on particular commodities that we looked at from a strategic sourcing perspective, like security, catering, and those kind of things. So we opened the door basically to allow suppliers to ask questions around, you know, how do they tap into the business, what are their business opportunities, what are the challenges that they're experiencing around completion of bid documents, and what kind of support that we can actually give them. There were key risks last year around CSD registration and how suppliers could actually be able to be onboarded to do business with government, and then we had various challenges in that regard. So key focus in the last year or two has been on CSD registration because it became compulsory that suppliers be registered on the central supplier database in order for them to do business. So somewhat our commodity focus kind of dropped a little bit in the last year because we had to reallocate our resource capacity to focus on challenges within the procurement environment, part of which was the cumbersome aspects of getting suppliers on the system for the CSD as well as payments and those kind of things. So we had key focus on that last year. Successes, I would think part of the biggest success is that we receive, and I think it may not necessarily be measurable, is the fact that our suppliers, when we are at those sessions, are very, they're taken in with the link that we open the door to actually scrutiny, the transparency on procurement processes, the ability of our officials to respond to questions, even though they may be challenging, and giving them that room to engage with government. I think that is one of the biggest, I think, take-home, you know, accolades that the team has actually put across. If you see in our various of our reports, in terms of the feedback, because we do at every event have a perception survey in terms of what, you know, the suppliers are indicating that has been valuable. They do indicate the understanding of the procurement process a little bit more, but they want more, obviously, particularly in rural areas, looking around spec and how they need to price empowerment initiatives around BEE. So we kind of get a sense. It's also a dipstick for us to see where we're not hitting the market, if it's local content that requires focus or is a particular commodity that suppliers are challenged within a particular community. It gives us that room to be able to understand the supply and demand. on, and there's a number of things that we actually pick up, and we use that to either develop our procurement policies further, or commodity strategies further, or identify other initiatives of key focus in determining how the unit actually operates with suppliers.
Yeah. Chair, just on that point with regards to training, we were in Beaufort West 2-3 weeks ago. Well, we were there a couple of times for the last 3 weeks. But actually it was nice to see some of the officials from finance, from Treasury, working with the municipality. And it was just nice to see these things, because you always read about it in the books. And so it's nice to see your officials on the ground working with the local municipality. Thanks for that. And just on that, what is the uptake in the municipalities that are suffering or that are struggling when it comes to finances, etc., when it comes to whether offers be made by Treasury, when it comes to training, or when it comes to assisting them when they're in trouble? Has there been some pushback from the municipalities when it comes, or has there been a receptive in saying, yes, Treasury with the skills, let's take them on board and let's see how we can utilize them, just on a side note?
Before I respond, Member Ace?
Departments or in your own department, and then secondly, do you as Treasury do you have a help desk where people can call in, ask for advice, and do you actually even send people out to give them some support? I don't say immediately, but to an extent that you are available to really take their hand and help them.
Okay, to answer the first question, I think the municipalities, it's depending on time and space where you find yourself on. We have had a very positive engagement process from the local government procurement unit in terms of the support that it provides to municipalities. So whenever there's an issue, they actually come forward and request help, and our team actually goes on board to assist them with various aspects, whether it's suppliers or in a tender process or not. However, you often get where there is something wrong, then there's always a reluctance to engage Treasury, because when we're on board, we look at everything. And so from a procurement process, when we review any bid or tender irregularity, it's about looking at an end-to-end process. So the response has been positive, but there are instances where you will get a pushback, and I don't know them off by hand, but it's depending on a case-by-case basis. But I think overall our municipalities in the Western Cape, they do engage the Treasury often, and they are willing to accept support and assistance and guidance from us. To the question, I think it also links to Member Ace's question in terms of the help. So within the provincial treasury for supply chain on the local and provincial side, we have a help desk, but it's broader than just like a call center help desk that we have. You deal with the help desk for the internal community, which is municipalities and departments. So our provincial departments and municipal officials can actually tap into policy direction, specific requirements and compliance, just guiding the procurement process forward in terms of what we do from a policy perspective. We also have a supplier help desk where suppliers can actually call in, and that's communicated on our website in our tender documents, and we monitor that rigorously. You'll find that an uptake of suppliers in the last 3 years have multiplied and quadrupled, to the point that in the previous financial year, and I haven't got the complete stats up until the last quarter, we dealt with like 7,000 queries coming in just to the provincial government office with suppliers. And largely it's the SCM reform process, it's CSD registration and queries, it's the e-procurement system and those kind of things. To reduce red tape, I think we have a bigger footprint with provincial departments, because the governance role of the Treasury is stronger in terms of the PFMA than the MFMA. So you can actually influence processing and uniform practices and procedures. So part of which in the last 5 years was reducing bid documents. So for example, a good example of reducing red tape would be the collapsing of our 4 bid documents into one, submission once only and stored in our Western Cape supplier database. So any supplier doing business with the Western Cape government does not need to submit 4 documents for every procurement process from a contract value of 2,000 upwards, because we house that centrally and we kind of update that information set on an annual basis. So once you'd register, and that is why, but it also brings up other challenges because we kind of have a dual mechanism where the national supply database does not have an evidence repository, and we do. So we have to manage that. And suppliers don't always understand that concept. But I think when you bring it home to them and they realize where it's cut off other red tape issues, then they're more understanding and accepting of our requirements. So even the e-procurement stuff, opportunity, and it opens up opportunity, but it's also asking questions around how much more. So in the national space, you'll have a three-quote system. In our system, it's open to more than one, more than three suppliers at a time. But that brings with it other questions around why didn't I get the bid, although despite the fact that it's only three that you actually need to. So you have a give and take. So when you're reducing red tape, it may introduce sometimes other governance requirements that a supplier needs to on board. And I think communication is something that we're not always strong at, and I think it's something that we need to work with in the Western Cape government. I think all of us, we do what we need to do, but I think we don't communicate that. And I think for me, I think key focus in this year would be how do we communicate these messages better across that the supplier understands exactly what we mean by X, Y, and Z, because we get complaints. I mean, and when that comes through, it's not really complaints of irregularity or non-compliance. It's basically misunderstandings. And once they engage with the Treasury, you clear up a lot of those. So the volumes of how we engage with suppliers is massive. But you need to be responsible in that space and how you package the information. And once that's done, I think the response is quite positive with suppliers. But it does require a different resource capacity and thinking within the procurement environment, with officials having to deal with that issue.
Thank you very much for the response. Members, we can move on to page 84. Member Bevanko, Member Simmers.
Chair, page 84 starts looking at the outlook for the coming financial year. And it starts with program 2 and goes on and on. Then you look at the APP, and I'm actually on page 25 of the APP, and you look at the strategic objectives starting with program 1, program 1.2, 1.3, and so on. And then you see the list of issues that will be dealt with under administration, and you ask yourself, but if this program is saying, if this outlook for the coming year is saying key areas of focus and delivery for the 2018-19 financial year mainly entail the continuing of key themes. Now, I would imagine that there are very key themes in Program 1. So why specifically? And the answer might be very simple. Why have you left out Program 1, not starting with continuing things that are happening or even improving on issues raised, for instance, on page 27 or page 26, continuing or improving what's happening in in Program 1, or is it just that it must start with Program 2? I'd just like to understand.
Thank you. Member Tertius Simmers.
Now, Chair, my question relates to the local government budget office. And early on, you know, we had a very in-depth discussion of the 1% impact on the provincial government. My logical question will be, because this specific office, you know, has an oversight role with local government in their budgetary processes, have they been able to assess the possible impact of the 1% increase in VAT on that sphere of government? If so, you know, if they perhaps issued any guidelines or directives, because most municipalities have now just concluded the adjustment budget process, and now they're moving towards the new budgetary process. But obviously, even this 1% has an impact on the adjustment budget process as well. And did this specific office give guidelines pertaining to that? Because obviously, I think it may have caught quite a few many municipalities off. And that's just a concern, because most municipalities tie their budgetary process to the IDP and the IDP's commitment regarding the public engagements they had, once again not being aware of this 1% and its possible impact.
Thank you. Questions over to Provincial Treasury.
Chair, I'm going to ask Ms. Smith maybe just to talk about the documentation on 84 and Program 1. I mean, it's more outward looking, but and I'll also ask Mr. Malela just to talk a little bit more about the local government budget office and what work we're doing there. But maybe just to start with the response by saying that, I mean, when this issue around the possible realization of the VAT increases, in fact, at that time when the MM Forum was held, I mean, the announcement was already made, and one of the key things that we had done is communicate to the MM Forum that, I mean, notwithstanding that some municipalities can, to a certain extent, claim input VAT is obviously going to be a part of the expenditure that is exempt from claiming input VAT. So we have raised that red flag with them. In fact, we've also raised an additional red flag, I mean, notwithstanding the separate spheres of government's negotiation processes. I mean, Mr. Malela will tell you that, you know, once the bargaining process is concluded, that sort of at the general bargaining council processes, these things tend to have an impact on the local government bargaining or wage negotiation process. So we've also raised that particular risk with them. And we've asked them, you know, just to take that into account in the planning processes. Ari, I don't know if you want
to
add.
No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, the 1% or 1 percentage point increase in VAT will have a lesser effect on municipalities than it has on provincial governments. I mean, as a provincial government, we're not registered for VAT. We do not charge for services that are VATable. In the case of municipalities, most of their revenues are VATable because, I mean, it comes in the form of service charges. The only money that's not VATable is obviously the portion that they get from national government. So, in fact, as Zach has indicated, is that they will have the opportunity to claim back through the input VAT system the additional VAT burden that's been placed on them by service providers, but also simultaneously pass on the 1 percentage point additional VAT charge to customers like you and I, you know, that must pay a little bit more now for electricity, for water, and for sanitation. Obviously, stuff like property rates is totally exempted from VAT. And then on the, maybe just to respond also on the, I think that's the response for the budget office stuff. We are going into a process now with municipalities to assess their budgets. And these risks must be taken into account. Obviously, they will table their draft budgets at the end of March. Then we'll go through a LGM tech process. And as Zach has also indicated at the recent MM forum, which was, I think it was last Friday, we have made them aware of these risks, particularly on the VAT, but more importantly, the other reductions that happened in the local government space, and how will that impact on communities? Because those things, they will have to take that into account when they have their public participation processes during the month of April and also during the month of May on the budgetary stuff, because it may mean that previous commitments made to certain communities may or may not realize, and to also pull that into the reviewed IDP document that must be tabled together with the budget.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I think this question that Honourable Member Simmers is asking is a real fundamental question also about the budgeting of municipalities, because just this week I tabled the budget performance in a cabinet meeting, and I must confess in this committee that it did not look very well, specifically as it relates to two things. One, the outstanding debt of municipalities, and the second one, I'm concerned about the capacity of municipalities to spend on the capital budget. The percentage is very low, so this is a very important issue that you raised. Also, we will be watching in the next quarter the impact of this VAT increase on the local government budgeting when I table in the next quarter the budget performance of municipalities and also in terms of the next technical assessments. I think one is also, I'm particularly concerned about the impact on the current national fiscal framework on municipalities. You have seen that when we met with you at the budget committee, that the provincial treasury did indicate that there were no cuts in the local government equitable share, but there are substantive cuts in the local government conditional grants, and those grants speak specifically to capital infrastructure. So those are quite to see these matters, but I think in the months to go ahead, we will certainly look at those issues.
Thank you. Member Beaver, are you covered for that?
No.
Question? There's a response coming now. Okay. Yes. Fine. Thank you.
The reason for not including Program 1 on the budget statement 2, so specifically around the outlook for the coming year, because the initiatives, as indicated in on page 84 on the outlook, is more external and the Program 1 is more internal, so we render the services to the different programs to enable or to support them to render their services to the provincial departments and municipalities. Not that Program 1 is not important, because without Program 1, they will not be able to do the services, but,
Thank you for the response. Member, just a follow-up, Member Ricardo.
Chairman, earlier on we talked about the VAT increase, obviously, and the impact on it, but I think something that I wanted to ask a follow-up question was the fuel increase and the cost of that and the fuel levy increase and the cost of that to the provincial services like vehicle, like the ambulances, the fleet, etc. And was there any particular numbers down or calculation done on that to see what the cost of that's going to be to provincial government? And obviously that wasn't 100% budgeted for, and where that funding going to come from? If Treasury can perhaps just give us some input on that. Thanks.
Thank you. Over to Treasury.
Yeah. Chair, I mean, that would be part of the input costing. I also need to state that, I mean, we got GMT to the point where they are much more responsive to the fuel price increases or decreases on a monthly basis. So the predictability for departments has actually improved, particularly over the last year. So if there's a decrease in the fuel price, the running cost for GMT vehicle for that particular month comes down, you know, in accordance with those fuel increases. Because obviously, remember, they're having two tariffs. They've got a tariff dealing with running costs, and then they've got a tariff dealing with the fixed cost. But I think in the same vein, you know, as we committed to do some calculation on the VAT, we can do the same to the committee in terms of particularly the fuel levy. But the principle to departments, sometimes prices goes up and down. There is a CPI inflationary increase in all the votes to deal with normal CPI inflationary increases. Obviously, if it's in excess of that, like in the case of the Department of Health, they would normally present it and we would normally assess it and then pull it into our budgetary processes.
Thank you, members. We do one more page before we take a short tea break. Page 85. Member H.
Thank you, Chairperson. Three questions. Last year you said you're going to support municipalities and increase their improve their responsiveness in the budget towards the socioeconomic policy objectives. I just want to understand what is the progress that you've made and in terms of that. Then there was also last year reference to the IDMS and that you're busy with a document and that document will be concluded. Did you conclude that document and you actually implement that? And thirdly, the UAMPS. If I can recall last year, you were almost like a post office for the UN, so not really interrogating what's in it. Did you increase your role and responsibility around the UN's and really see that it's applied and there's proper direction and criteria and things like that? Impression from some of the votes is they complete the UN's every year, but, I mean, nothing really comes of it. So just understand your role in terms of the UMs. Did you increase and improve, if I can call it that, on your responsibility in terms of the UMs? Was it still just transport and public works and they take final decisions? Thank you.
Yeah, Chair, maybe I can just respond. The work that we are doing on the IDMS is still ongoing. Remember, there was a commitment that we made in concert with the Department of Education, Health, and Public Works to review the current issue around, you know, having Transport and Public Works is an implementing agent, and given the fact that the IDMS has been in operation for the last, probably the last 7-8 years or so, that it's time to review it. I mean, that's part of the work that we have in our APP and in our operational plans, is to review that. So that is still ongoing, and obviously we will work, you know, as program two, together with our infrastructure colleagues in Treasury. I'm talking about the asset management side, so it's Isaac and his team. And then on the UMs, I think we play a little bit more than just a post office role. In fact, we assist both the UMs and also the CM. So what the member will see is that in our APP for this year, the targets on the assessments of the UMs has also been adjusted. And in fact, what we've also done is even on the CM, we've also adjusted that, because we've now pulled the Department of Human Settlements also into the frame of assessing the CM. And then obviously with the UMs, we do it for all the departments. We've also strengthened our IDMCs, that's the Infrastructure Committee. In addition to that, there's also been a MyCOCO that's now been established under the political leadership of Minister Meyer, where he's actually pulled in all the infrastructure departments. We've extended also our infrastructure assessment process to include public entities like Cape Nature, as an example. So we look at all the deliverables that they're doing. And then also key department that's also now been included is the Department of Social Development under the infrastructure package. And all of that is reflected under the performance indicators of my program. The my COCO, standing for Ministerial Infrastructure Committee, includes obviously the ministers for human settlements, health, education, the minister chairs it, and their key responsibility is to report back to cabinet on how we're doing on the infrastructure side. We also obviously, given that the gambling board is here, we make sure that the responsible departments also pull in the UMs of the respective entities into the compilation of the UMs for those respective departments. So we have strengthened it. Obviously, the main issue, member Ace, is still the issue around capacity. We've also received a letter from National Treasury where they've asked us to make funding available to strengthen the infrastructure component. We've done so as a Treasury, and we have provided some funding in the revenue fund to the Treasury vote to actually deal with those requirements. Obviously, there are issues around job evaluation, etc. That's been conducted at the moment at the national level, and they will come back and say to us these are the various levels and also some standard structures. But we really starting to zoom in, and we're also having similar initiatives, member Ace, on the municipal side. So our infrastructure team focuses on departments, and they also focus on municipalities. And the one of the key initiatives this year, and that's also in the APP for Program 2, is actually to have an IDMS for municipalities. And that's also work in process, and we'll take the lessons that we've learned from our own internal processes and apply that in the development of an IDMS in the municipal space.
Chair, I think this is a very important matter. I think I'm very sorry that the perception exists that we are a post office in terms of the UMP. As Harry substantively indicated, we have now taken control substantively for this. We have more than 2,000 buildings. And we are also looking at, in the Infrastructure Committee, for the business continuity plans in the case of the drought escalating. We are also now specifically looking at every department in terms of the maintenance budget, the repairs, and more also specifically also the spending patterns for new infrastructure. You would have noticed that I've tabled a budget of 25 billion rand for infrastructure, and our view in the provincial treasury, that's one of the single biggest spending items on the budget, and therefore we have committed ourselves to monitor and review the infrastructure spending, particularly in the big departments. And this year I will specifically focus on the issue of the maintenance and repairs of specifically hospitals and schools, because 25 billion rand is quite a lot of money over the next 3 years. And so we are committed We also have now included the 7.7 billion rand budget of human settlements into this infrastructure coordinating committee. And I'm very pleased that this Wednesday I have tabled a report in the cabinet about the infrastructure spending in the Western Cape government. And I want to report that we are quite happy with these particular spending. In addition to this committee, we are also now paying site visits to this infrastructure. We have also listed the top 10 infrastructure projects. The one current biggest infrastructure project now in this Western Cape is more than half a billion, and that relates to the road between Aston and Montague. And we are monitoring this infrastructure spending. We also, there's a total national, provincial, and local, we are spending about 9 billion rand in the Saldanha IDZ. In that specific case, we had the whole cabinet on sea to go and see what this oil and gas industry is, given the quantum of the investment that we are making in that specific space. So yes, I think we have now zoomed, as Harry correctly pointed out, zoomed specifically into this infrastructure as oversight. I've also asked all the mayors of the various municipalities if they see anywhere, and this also goes for this committee, if you see any infrastructure spending project of this government that in your view at that time when you see it is not going well, you are free to send, take a photo on your phone, send that thing to me on a WhatsApp, and within a 1 hour or so, we will be on site sending somebody from this government to see what is happening. We don't want to wait a year later and say something is wrong. We want to be there hands-on because infrastructure spending is one of the commitments of this government. We call it infrastructure-led growth. And because the job creation is so crucial in this particular regard, I also had a conversation with Minister Grant, because I said to him, there's no water in certain towns, how can we spend 25 billion rand? And he assured me that there are alternative building technologies and building strategies. For example, PPC Cement is willing and already agreeing to bring pre-mixed cement to the Western Cape from other provinces. So we're particularly happy that the infrastructure spending will not significantly be affected as a result of the drought.
Thank you for the response, Member Asa, you covered a follow-up?
Yes, those two, thank you. Just the one on the budget of local authorities and the, to target more the socio-economic policy objectives and coordination.
Thank you. With regards to the progress on, on the socio-economic responsiveness, I think there are two elements that I can mention. The one is the objective that the Provincial Treasury has to promote the use of socioeconomic information in the evidence-based planning and budgeting practices. And with regards to that, the Treasury does issue the Municipal Economic Review and Outlook publications, as well as earlier in this year also issued all the municipalities the socioeconomic profiles that can be used in the planning and budgeting process. So the provision of the information is one thing, and then assisting the municipalities with the application of the implications of the socioeconomic information is another element, and that is done through a number of mechanisms. One is through the integrated work plan, and that guides the engagements with the municipalities at a strategic level. And as part of that, the information is disseminated to the municipal officials. And basically guidance is given in terms of how to interpret these things for the plans and budgets going forward. What we have found is that most municipalities, if not all, are definitely using the information that's been provided in the development of their IDPs. But nonetheless, it is something that we are continuously working on with the municipalities. And another thing is about also assisting with understanding the levers that's available for socioeconomic responsiveness, and in this regard we work with different partners. On the one side, it's also with our partners in procurement of how municipalities can use their procurement spend for local economic development, and in that regard there's also been some progress.
Thank you for the response. Members, we're going to take, and officials, we're taking a 10-minute break. 12-minute break till 5 to 9 o'clock. Thank you.
But I mean, is that one table and the somebody table that you guys normally have there? Yeah, it's like that. Yeah, they all ask this. But we got this from you. Yeah, we got it from you. No, we didn't do it ourselves. We got it from you guys.
I'll ask that to see what it is. Just need all the reason I can talk to them. Okay, I just thought so because I got clashes now. Okay. What? Okay. Okay, maar ik is zolang je niet weet, wat woensdag is ik met die premier, nee? Die ochtend. So, die ochtend is ik weet niet wat later die dag aan gaat. Maar je moet mijn dag boeken één julende dag. Dat is ook om je hier misschien die clashes gaan opstellen. Okay, cool. No, ik heb net je gebeld van ik heb nou vanochtend gezien aan de clash nou met direct de draadmeeting en die niet in, in wat de naam nou in jouw naam. See you later. Bye.
Yeah, I think it's very clear.
And in terms of some of the
yeah,
I think it's probably.
Thank you, we are ready to start. Baie dankie. Ons is gereed om te begin. Om voort te gaan. Okay, we will continue with page 86. Member Ace.
Chairperson, just in terms of the progress with the integrated financial management system, whether the green light is there and whether National is going ahead and you as part of that going ahead as well. So I just want to understand the progress and implementation, Chair.
What about Provincial Treasury?
Yeah, Member Ace, we're still a pilot project. The problem is that the implementation plan is on a continuous basis been shifted to later date. Yes, from the National Treasury perspective, the project is still going ahead. I think at this point in time, they do have some challenges, procurement challenges. Although they have appointed a software provider, there's still implementation agents that they need to to a point, is it, it's envisaged that only in 2021 that it will really reach the Western Cape. In the meantime, together with the departments, we've identified areas within our current systems for improvement, and we're currently working on that. For this particular year, we're working with some of the larger departments where they want to move a bit further in terms of integrating some of the financial information, particularly on BAS, Logos, and personal. And so we're working on projects with them. And the reason why we're doing it is actually also a part of our preparation phase if we're implementing the IVMS. But at this point in time, it's still touch and go. We're still part of the pilot initiative, but as I've indicated, it's about the implementation dates. It's always shifted, you know, and as I've indicated, 2021, it's envisaged that it will reach us in the Western Cape.
Thank you. Page 87, number 8.
Chairperson, just briefly, I know we're going to get the full presentation later on in this year on in terms of the database, supplier database. I just want to briefly understand, do we still run the two databases, the central one and the Western Cape one, and what is the integration, if I can call it, happening, and when is that going to happen? And then on that page as well, Chairperson, just on graph, I think last year you reported that there's major progress that's been made with municipalities in terms of graph. There was one outstanding, I believe it was Kanaland, and just to ask, what's the progress in terms of that one municipality?
Over to the department. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. There is still a two-database process, however they're used for different things. So the CSD is there for the compliance profiling of the supplier, like the tax clearance, the BE requirements, their banking details, and that's used as the main data source in which you link with your e-procurement systems and your basic accounting system. The Western Cape supplier data, there is some level of duplication because what we found in the past, we were not ready to transit completely into the CSD because of data sets being conflicted and certain data credibility issues. However, we've kind of moved quite, I think the National Treasury has moved quite progressively with that. There are some challenges on timing and the system being not available at times. So we found that we needed to have, to keep our business continuity going, we needed to manage a dual process. So up until we get a sense of confidence that we can switch off those requirements that are being dealt with in the national space, what will happen is the Western Cape supplier database will become what we call a evidence bank, because there's a two-pronged approach to governance. One is the basic compliance approach, and then the evidence that supports your decision-making in the procurement process. So if you claim, if you say I'm a BE level 4, what is your evidence to support it in the procurement process? And that the second leg will be housed in the Western Cape space, because that will assist our 13 departments in their procurement process. So right now, it's still for different purposes. There is somewhat a level of duplication, but it has to be there given that we now, you know, get the level of confidence in the governance space for our departments so that they keep their clean audits and all of that going forward. So up until we get that confidence, there will be a switch over, but there's no integration per se. So it's a manual set of comparative analysis that's happening with the departments.
Thank you. On the graph side?
Maybe just to indicate, I mean, the specific question around Kanaland, they have not achieved a clean audit. In fact, I think it was a qualified audit, if I recall correctly. And that audit result was released about 3 weeks ago.
Have they implemented GRAP successfully, Chairperson, or not? And what is your role in assisting them to do that?
We have assisted that municipality with an implementation manager, that's the right word, implementation manager to assist them with the accounts. I mean, they've also appointed a CFO a couple of months ago. I mean, they have had capacity challenges, and we have been trying to assist them. Chair, I can try and, after this meeting, give the committee specific report back around what their specific non-compliances were that led to the qualified audit.
Chair, in direct questions to Honourable Member Ace, because of these capacity problems, I went there specifically to that municipality. I had a meeting with my treasury team, with the mayor and the speaker. And post that, we have also given them 1.3 million rand to specifically support them with an implementation manager. One was 800,000 rand and one was 500,000 rand. I think 1.3 million we gave them. So we are supporting that municipality in terms of the implementation strategy. You will recall that they are still under the financial recovery plan. That's one of the interventions that we are currently busy monitoring. But there are also other some capacity problems and of that municipality, and currently we are looking into it. They received in the year before a disclaimer, and they have now made some little bit progress. It's still a qualified audit that they have received, and we are committed to see that we support that municipality given the capacity constraints there.
Follow-up members, you want that report? Fine. Okay, fine. Thank you. Page 89.
Chairperson, reprioritization, you referred there to the goods and services budget was reduced by 6.3 million. And this has the unintended consequence of reducing the scope of and limiting the number of delaying certain projects. Now, first of all, why did you cut on the goods and services, spelling out that there's certain aspects that are going to be delayed? And I would like to understand what will be delayed if you look at that. And then secondly, to what extent have you implemented the new BEE codes within the department and government?
Member Ricardo?
Chairperson, yes. On that as well, the capital asset refreshment period, and it's obviously a good thing what the department is doing, how do you work with the government departments? Because obviously now that money is tight, the pair of shoes will need to last you a year longer. And now that you've done, it looks like you're doing it in your department. How are you doing it with other departments as well? And is that 4 years, if you can just give an idea as to what sort of assets are we looking at? Are we just looking at physical? Are we looking at all furniture, chairs? Or what exactly are we looking at? And I know we're going to come to the Western Cape Gambling Board. And actually, I think we did discuss this in the previous meeting as well about the Western Cape Gambling Board generating revenue, but then we're still allocating funding from them as a line item for the department. And I think there is a process undergoing, but I think we can, if we don't want to get into detail now, we can deal with it at another meeting as well. Just on that, thank you.
Chair, I'll ask Mr. Malina just to talk about the gambling board's revenue and the taxation and how that flows. But then just to come back to point four, I think Member McKenzie, I think you've appropriately commented this, you know, it's really just about how do we make that shoe stretch a little bit longer. In fact, what we had done in the run-up to the finalization of the budget, I mean, there were early indications that we all votes would be under pressure and provincial treasury would also be affected. So we've gone through the exercise of understanding how the reductions would affect us. Obviously, it's not we're not able to disengage, I mean, on the personnel cost. I mean, that's almost a fixed cost, if I can call it that. And that's why we've also gone through this process of understanding how which posts are critical, which ones we find to fund, etc. And that was on the personnel side. Then obviously what we wanted to do, try and do is minimize the impact of the reductions on the transfer payments versus goods and services. So we looked at both our responses in that regard. And one of the things that we realized was an option to actually stretch out our capital replacement program, mainly laptops and furniture and so on. So instead of replacing them every 3 years, which is the life cycling, we stretch it out to four to five years. That's the one part. And then on some of the projects that we envisage in the different programs, for an example, one of the planned projects was the rollout of the implementation of Isaac Logos at education. Yeah, that's the one. As an example, where we had to now decide defer or spread the project over a longer period of time, etc. And we had to apply that sort of principles in terms of understanding how could we manage the budget reductions over the MTIF.
Just on the and with regards to other departments, are you working with them as well? And then also just with regards to vehicles, are we looking at? And I know we're going to get to our favorite entity, government motor transport, but are you looking or at least advising them with that regard as well.
I'm going to ask Ms. Malila to add, but I mean the principles that we've applied within the vote are the same principles that we've advocated to the, throughout the budget process. I mean we've gone through, I think since MTEC 1, there were two sets of engagements, and in MTEC 2 another round of engagements. So we've in fact gone through three rounds of engagements just to make sure that we have a coherent response as government to the budgetary or the fiscal constraints. And I mean one of the mechanisms that we've utilized is a tool called the MITS model, and we've asked departments to tell us what are they going to maintain, innovate, terminate, and so on. So I think the key thing for us, I mean the message I want to give the committee is that what the methodology that was applied is generally consistent throughout all of government.
Senior, that's absolutely correct, and I mean in the case of GMT, they are an entity within the Department of Transport and Public Works. So typically in finance terms we call them a trading entity, and obviously the deductions have to be applied equally to the various entities. On the gambling board, and I mean we'll probably come there later as you've indicated, we've just recently published a set of regulations on adjusting the cost and fees, and in fact we haven't received any comment on those. So the fees that will come mostly to the gambling board from an administrative perspective, that will be adjusted from 1 April onwards, and then there are also other initiatives at place where we actually look at some of the fees that's supposed to go to the gambling board to make them more self-sustainable, because that is ultimately the aim. In the absence of that share, we have no choice but to provide them with a transfer payment to deal with the operational requirements for that entity to collect the quantum of revenue that Minister has indicated.
Thank you very much. Page 89. Sorry,
what was the second one? Billion rand and goods and services, and the other one was the BE codes.
Remember, yeah, thank you.
But how are we doing on our implementation in Nadia? Just provincially, perhaps?
Okay, so I'm just looking a little bit of clarity. So so there's two aspects: the BE Act, which defines the sector-specific codes. So not all of these sectors have been issued with a procurement code in terms of actually being compliant within the procurement environment. So what we have implementation of is the PPP requirements as defined in the PPP regulation in 2017. So we regularly monitor that together with actually looking at our spend and how that's allocated. So there's quarterly reporting where we actually look at a spend segmentation of what are the key focus in terms of the 80-20, 90-10 principle, in terms of women and men, in terms of BE companies, SMMEs. So there's a detailed report that we provide on a quarterly basis to all our accounting officers and CFOs in the province, as well as our minister getting that a consolidated report of the province so that he can have oversight of that. So we are in a fair state. At least 80 to 86% of our previous spend have actually gone to SMME companies as targeted by the regulations, despite the new requirements that have come in terms of pre-qualification and subcontracting. So just applying the preference point system in itself, there's already a fair representation of a footprint of BE participation in our provincial spend. We are looking at the moment in dealing with an overall economic procurement policy that is linked to our MTBPS and some of the objectives that we've actually put in the medium-term budget policy statement, and seeing what are the opportunities to actually look at further empowerment initiatives within the procurement process, and that is being currently consulted with the Department of the Premier and the Economic Development Department across the province with our stakeholders to put a document on the table that can speak to further empowerment initiatives.
Jim, maybe then to just talk to two things about the vote. As part of the 2018 budget, I mean, Vote 3 had to incur a reduction to its baseline of about 13 million. And of that 13 million, 6 million was applied to the goods and services budget. Then, Chair, I think just to follow up in relation to the comments that Nadia made, I mean, as a department, I mean, we're obliged to follow the procurement procedures, and, I mean, typically our expenditure is going in the right direction. I mean, obviously we're guided by the tenders and the bids that we receive, and we apply the preferencing system as part of the procurement processes within the department. Shana, I don't know if you want to add anything.
Okay. If I can speak to the reduction of goods and services, the 6.3 million, the bulk of the reduction came from our consultants. We've got once of consultants in program one instead of extending. Then there's also the Logos rollout, as the HOD mentioned. And then we also looked at linked to the reduction is our assets that we're also going to save on, and then general operating costs like travel and subsistence, where we decide you don't have to go on a travel for a 1 hour meeting, and it's reductions in those costs that also add up to the 6.3. So the bulk is consultants.
Members, follow up.
The goods and services budget was reduced by 6.3, and this is having an unintended consequence of reducing the scope of limiting the number of delaying certain projects. I want to know which projects are being delayed because there was not 6.3 million rand available on the goods and services.
Chair, I've given two examples. So one is the refreshment of the assets, and then also the deferment of the Logos project. I mean, that was quite a substantial portion, and I'm going to just look around the table. I think there may have been research stuff. Marshall, anything from your side? No? Chair, we can provide you with a full list. I mean, I'm just picking the top two or three things that's on the top of my head.
Thank you for that. Page 89. Member Bevenkoff, thank you.
Chair, I'm just going to do a general thing for 89 and 91, where just comparing the receipts and the payments. And if you remember earlier on, I asked, can I please be informed which program is going to speak to empowerment of women specifically? I didn't get that response yet. Then specifically on page 91, connected to page 115, transfers and subsidies to provinces and municipalities, connect that to page 115, which is your annexure. And then I won't bother any further because we'll get those things later. What is strange is the narrative underneath, which says it then breaks down over the MTF what is being allocated to municipalities. On page 115 and on page 117 and 116 and on page 117, and it says there's one common sentence that says specifically, especially support to the most vulnerable municipalities. Now when you look at those allocations, you don't pick up which is the most vulnerable, though we know which are the most vulnerable, yet the allocations are basically the same. So how do you then determine which are the most vulnerable, that word, and differentiate in terms of the allocations to the different municipalities in terms of what we give them? I can understand the one where it says that capacity building grant. It would just be fair that you give everybody the same in terms of a capacity building grant. But management support, I'm sure some municipalities are better off than others in terms of management. I also think that some of them are better off in terms of a few other things in terms of their financial planning and that sort of thing. So shouldn't there be I wouldn't call it a sliding scale, but just a difference in the way that we make these allocations to municipalities? That's basically all that I want to ask about the budget, because what we've discussed here before would then be valued in terms of what the different programs have. But I have also picked up, and I'm just leaving this here, a disconnect between what's in the budget and how the APP is put together. Because there's often a sentence that reads, if I can just put it here, I've discussed it with one of the officials earlier, understands what I'm trying to say. The sentence reads, and it's across the board, reconciling performance targets with the budget and MTF. So when I read that, I expect to see a target and a budget attached to it. But what's underneath it is just a repeat of the budget for that program. This heading, I believe, is a template that's given, and they have to put it there. But it doesn't connect in what means. It doesn't connect in the way that it's here. Because you know that we always want to know, as we go quarterly, how much have you spent on that program, how much have you spent on that budget. But globularly, it should be in here so that we can pick it up. Because else, the APP becomes a completely separate document and not one that dovetails with the budget. If you understand what I'm saying.
Thank you, Member Bianco. But just, Member McKenzie, I'm going to give you a chance now. But on the first part of your question relating to women empowerment, I think you, yours, yeah, Member Bianco, you asked that question out of your experience of Vote 2 and what's going on there in Parliament. In Parliament, and then you asked earlier on how provincial treasury could support women empowerment. That's how I understood you. So I think we will have to engage more specifically with provincial treasury about women empowerment, the concept, because I think we must be on the same page in knowing what you mean by that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I just very briefly explain, Chair? One of the imperatives at these conferences for women, especially the Commonwealth ones, is that we should, in our role, see to it that gender sensitivity is taken into account when budgets are compiled, meaning the full budget or departmental budget, and there should be something that stands out in a program that says, in this program, or in this vote, that's how we're going to look after women in terms of whatever they're going to do. So my question to Treasury was just, what is Treasury doing specifically to empower women? And that question can be asked of every other vote if we really want to do justice to what we got there and how we should implement what we learned there.
I would very much like to maybe give a ballpark response to the most vulnerable municipalities, because this for me is also a key priority of myself. And I think the member is correct. She says that they know who these most vulnerable municipalities are. And it is still Matsikama, Cedarburg, Lanesburg, Beaufort West, Central Karoo and Kanalan. These are the most vulnerable municipalities. Now the question is, where is this individual amounts for the various vulnerable municipalities? I think part of the local government MTEC engagements and the various visits, the time visits to the various municipalities, we discover that the needs may vary from town to town. And based on our engagements with the various municipalities, determining on the basis of the need, we develop then a memorandum of agreement with these various municipalities. And because the need vary, the allocations will vary. In the provincial treasury, they also have an MFMA coordinator and an MFMA a team that does the assessments and the regular discussions. And from time to time, I pop in there to see what is happening in those meetings, because it's part of the work also of the local government budget office to also see those things that emerge from those engagements factor into those MOAs, and then we will then separately issue a allocations and transfer to the various municipalities based on the memorandum of agreement. This is a standard practice that we currently follow. So although you don't see it right now during the course of the engagements, you will further then see, and we're quite happy to bring this to the Standing Committee of Finance, which specific municipalities get which specific allocations based on the memorandum of agreement.
Chair, the question that Member Bevanko raised, it's a valid question around how we go about budgeting for those sort of initiatives. So, we'll take that into consideration to see how we can improve that. But there isn't a specific line item in the current charter of accounts that deals with that. But, I can ask Ms. Smith just to maybe elaborate on some of the women in management and women in treasury initiatives that are not necessarily sort of line item budgeted for, but you can maybe just talk about one or two things in that regard.
With respect to the
I'm not referring to, and the request is not departmentally. It's out there. Though I know Treasury is not the service delivery department. You have other priorities. But if I do justice to what we've been asked to do, I need to ask the question.
Point taken, thank you. They will respond. Treasury, HOD?
Chair, I just want to ask Mr. Malila just to talk about supplement some of the comments the Minister made around the processes that we follow regarding the transfers to the municipalities.
Yeah, Chair, maybe just before I get there, maybe just also to respond to Member Beerwinkel's question. I mean, this matter came up probably over the last 10 years or so, you know, and it also relates to what are you budgeting for youth, as an example. What are you budgeting for disabled? What are you budgeting for women? What we can maybe do as part of our treasury work, maybe we're not going to give a commitment, maybe to give it for the next month, is maybe next quarter or so, you know, do an analysis. Now we can do an analysis of what is in the budget for certain categories of the population. Obviously taking into account that, as an example, if one just look at the population breakup, most of the funding in education would in all probability be targeted at although it's all children, but most of them would be female children, as an example. We can do the same in social development and then maybe try and pick up some special initiatives, you know, that is happening out there, and whether it's in bursary programs or normal line item programs, and then maybe even link it to particularly what's happening in the supply chain side around contracts that's gone to particularly women ownership, women empowerment, etc. I think that's the kind of response that she's looking for. Just to come back to the issue around the municipalities, we definitely have an allocation criteria, and we definitely look at the most vulnerable. And maybe just to clarify, if one look as an example on page 115, and we look at the money that's been allocated in 2017-2018, we can see that of the 33 million that's gone, the largest part went to Oudtshoorn and then Kannaland. They each got 3.3 and 3.5 million. Then followed by Beaufort West, Knysna, Central Karoo District Municipality, and then Overberg District Municipality. So, and then obviously there are small amounts for Cedarburg, but that's also over the million rand. And if one just aggregates that, then we would see that the most vulnerable municipalities, and we've got a criteria for it. So we can say, it, as an example, you know, most vulnerable, but not most vulnerable, and then less vulnerable. And we do that in relation to all our initiatives. What the members can also see is that in relation to the support grant, which Member Beerwinkel also referred to on 117, that grant is the training grant. So that is the bursary grant that's gone to all the municipalities. And for now, we've allocated the same amount to everybody, but the criteria is different. So as an example, we would say if you're in the city of Cape Town, we want a minimum of 3 students per year for the 120,000. But if you live more than, I think it's 120 or 180 kilometers away from a tertiary institution, it's a minimum of 2. So in that way, we differentiate given where they may find themselves. And the next step, obviously, is once the students get from the university, is then to look at different criteria to actually allocate the total quantum of about 3.6 million to the various municipalities. We also have the same thing when there's a big chunk that's been given for the standard chart of account allocations. So the city of Cape Town, as an example, would receive a smaller amount than some of the other municipality, given the capacity that they have and the state of their vulnerability. We would then appropriately adjust our allocations. And then just lastly, obviously in 18-19, there is a portion that is unallocated. So once we get to those allocations during the adjusted estimates, the members will then see the full picture of how these allocations go to the various municipalities, and they are all informed by evidence. And as Minister has indicated, they're also all informed by business plans, so we can say to the committee exactly what is it that it's intended for, and then we apply our ordinarily oversight processes, and all these stuff are also audited by both external auditors, but particularly also internal audit. And part of the plan this year, we've again asked internal audit, come and look at the grants that we're giving to municipalities, come and assess whether we're getting value for money and how can we improve our processes, particularly in relation to it, because it's about close to about 10% of our total envelope in the vote.
Thank you, Member. Member Bevan, can follow?
When we were given the presentation, sorry, there was a page that said the total budget expenditure over the six regions. I don't have it with me now. Now, that is where this information disconnects for me when you say the most vulnerable, because then I also look at the most vulnerable areas, but you don't have to respond to it now. We can do this on another day. But just think of this and that picture that you had. It doesn't connect.
Thank you, Member McKenzie. Still want to follow up?
No.
Okay, so we covered. Page 90. Page 91. I think we've already spoke to that. Page 92. Page 93. Page 94. Page 95. Page 96. Page 97.
Just at the top, 97. Referring to the reserves there, we saw that there's a lot of reserves that's been put aside, or money in reserves. Is there any specific strategy around reserves? Do you have a ceiling or do you have an upper limit? Do you have a percentage at which of the budget you're aiming for, 1%, 2%, 3%, and to say, well, once we have 2% to 1%, we're not going to go above that in terms of our contingencies and the reserves for that. Just to understand where you're aiming at and where you're going to stop with the reserves.
Chair, you will see the practice that we normally employ is to try and have our reserves, particularly in the first year of the budget, at around maximum 2% of the total expenditure. In this year, 2018-19, our total reserves amount to about 970 million or provisions that we've set aside. That amount is carried through, and obviously in the middle year it jumps to about 1.9 because there's a 700 million that's been set aside for the improvement in conditions of services that I've spoken about earlier, the issue around the wage bill. And then that amount again is carried through then with the additional amount in the last year that's also been provided for the possible implications of the wage bill. So a 2% buffer we believe is more appropriate, but I think what's important for the committee to note, it's not just a contingency reserve, but it's a reserve to deal with other things like cost pressures, service load demands, and particularly the issue around fiscal fiscal stabilization. So in relation to just unforeseen, unavoidable, it's probably about 0.3% of the total budget to deal with any extraordinaries that might happen in the year, whether it's fires or floods, etc. But a 2% buffer, and one can even look internationally, even if we look at our own budget that's been set aside nationally and the quantum of reserves that's been set aside in the budget, it was also more or less in that region. And I mean, it's been proven over the last couple of years that it's a kind of a safe zone to play in.
Thank you for the response. Page 98, 99, 100, 101, 102, 103, 104, 105, 109.
I see there's an increase of 29% on the consultants and professional services. If you can just clarify that one, please.
Over to Provincial Treasury, the consultants.
Thank you, Chair. The consultants are in terms of the there's an education research as well as a BER fuel level research that we performed in terms of the fiscal policy unit, and then there are also evaluations that will be done by the budget provincial government budget unit, And then in terms of program 3, there's also an amount of 1 million that's set aside for the PT warehouse. And then there's also the threat sourcing as well as business analyst that will be under the supply chain provincial government unit. And those will be dealing in terms of the SCM engineering and reform. Ms. Ibrahim alluded to that earlier. And then in terms of the support and interlinked financial system, there's also another 2.9 million that was set aside. That's in terms of the logist rollout. The amount was actually supposed to be far higher than that, but with the cuts that we had to do, we could only accommodate 2.9 million.
Can we maybe get a document or a pager just to indicate that? Because, I mean, you can't follow each and every one, but if we can get the breakdown of that 25. But may I ask a question? Did I hear fuel levy research, and why?
Chair, I mean, as part of the work that we are doing, I mean, we're doing various research. Also in the document, we are expressing a view on some of our domestic resource mobilization initiatives. The members may recall that we've done research in this area previously. We believe that the timing is probably right now just to update that research as a start, to get it obviously in line with the requisite legislative provisions. And then obviously once we have the results of that is then to determine which way forward. Obviously the key thing is to look at the financial implications if we intend to have any proposals in that regard. So we're not suggesting that there will be a fuel levy in the province, but it's part of our initiatives to increase our own revenue as a provincial government.
Yes, Chairperson, if you see over the years, we continuously face budget cuts for the last 10 years. Every year, budget cuts. And so you have to look at in terms of the current own receipts that we have here. You've seen it in the documentation in the main budget. It's in the region of 3 billion. We're quite happy that in the last 2 years it has increased from 2.4 billion rand over to 3 billion rand. But I think as we see the impact of the wage, the impact of the VAT and all of these things, and the impact of the fuel, we have seen that 2 years ago we wanted to initially started with a further work in terms of the fuel levy. By that time, we have seen that Minister Pravin Gordhan at the time, he announced a fuel levy countrywide. So we thought it is not a good time now to think about the fuel levy when he introduced the fuel levy. But subsequently, I have been to the Cabinet, and the Cabinet has given me a mandate to further investigate and proceed with the further research work about the fuel levy and the implications of the fuel levy. While we have also seen that the time frame for the real implementation of a fuel levy will take time over a period of 6 years. So this is not something that's going to happen in my lifetime even here. It's going to be quite a lot of research because a lot of legislative provisions needs to be made even within the National Assembly. They have to table through the National Minister of Finance also enabling legislation, because a fuel levy is a money bill, and a money bill has also cross-border implications to other places. So it is not something that's going to happen immediately, but there was initial research done. This government has received permission from a former Minister of Finance, Minister Trevor Manuel at the time, to proceed. He has given us approval with a fuel levy, but subsequently the times or context have changed considerably. And since the Cabinet has now given me a mandate to pursue the issue of a fuel levy, it is now necessary for us to commission new research to update that particular research. And there's a long process of consultation and the whole process of involvement with the various committees. So it is only now in the research phase. And as I said, this is not going to happen now. There's a 6-year lead time before it can happen.
Thank you, Minister. But what is the purpose of the current fuel levy at the national level and the role of the province or metros at this current stage then? What role do we have and what benefit does the province get?
Well, as you have seen annually in terms of the administration and the management of the national fuel levy, the fuel levy is allocated to the metros, and we have seen that in more or less all the metros except Nelson Mandela, they get quite less than that. but I've seen in the Gazette, it's about 2 billion rand that each of these metros get. I think in the context of Nelson Mandela, it's about 1.2 or 3 billion rand. And that fuel levy goes into the various metros. The question is always, what about the district? You will recall that there was a regional services levy. That levy has been converted now into a RSC replacement levy that makes provision for municipalities, districts. In that particular regard, and the fuel levy is now for the metros. The question is always, what must we do with the fuel levy that is paid into the metros? I strongly argue that we must ring fence that particular money for road infrastructure within the context of the metros. The National Treasury is obviously have different views. I'm quite happy that in the last budget council, when I raised this matter, the FFC, the Finance and Fiscal Commission, agrees with me that we need to ring fence that particular amount for road maintenance. But of course, currently what happens, the City of Cape Town take that 2 billion rand and just put it on top of their revenue fund and just make it part of the normal pot in terms of the reallocation of the budget. I'm convinced and I believe that it must be ring fenced specifically for road maintenance and infrastructure.
Thank you, page 110, 111, 12, 113, 114, 115, 116.
Chairperson, on the financial management support grant, I see that there's certain allocations and there's still an unallocated amount of 16 million rand. Could you determine of what to allocate and what not to allocate, and when will that 16 million be allocated, and which criteria will you use?
That is exactly what I answered. We'll repeat. That is exactly the answer that I gave earlier in terms of the allocation for these various municipalities in terms of the visits that we will pay to the various municipalities. Based on that visits, we do a needs assessment and determine a memorandum of agreement, and then we allocate it. For now, for us to allocate individual amounts would not be the right thing to do because we are busy with local government visits and stuff. So that is part of that engagement.
Listen, that's not the question. The question is, you've done an allocation.
No, I'm talking about...
On what criteria did you do the allocation?
Which one are you now talking about?
I'm referring to the finance management support grant.
No, but you refer to the unallocated...
Yes, absolutely.
Where is that? Which page is that?
116.
Okay. Are you talking about this 2018... The 16.67 million.
Yes, compared to the allocation that's already been done.
Okay, Eric will then answer that. Sorry, then I misread your answer. Question.
Yeah, Chair, on page 116, the portions that's been allocated it's made out of two things. It's actually commitments that carry through. So normally if we allocate funding to a municipality for a particular project, that project might run over 2 years. And this obviously gives recognition to that. And then also that allocation forms part of the, the SCOA funding that also carries through because it's a reform that carries through over 3 years. But mainly it relates to money that has been committed as part of project funding. And then the unallocated portion, we will deal with that once we've done with all our processes. And I've mentioned to the committee that we are doing the budget assessment process now, that is in May. And then obviously we've just had our technical engagements with municipalities. We will then have further strategic engagements in terms of the IDP and the planning processes later in the year, that's around September. And then we will allocate the funding finally when we get to the adjusted estimate process. I think the positive point, Chair, is you may recall in previous years, so if you go back as an example to the main appropriation of last year, it's a good example, we had almost the full amount as unallocated. We've shifted that approach this year, and you can see that almost half of the money for support have already been earmarked in the budget. It means that municipalities can plan now. They don't need to wait till the adjusted estimate. So year after year, we're trying to improve our processes in terms of allocating the funding. Hopefully this year also, most of these amounts should be cleared out when we get to more or less September, and then we will then put it into the Gazette and you will see it in the adjusted estimates. But it's a process where we try and continuously improve the way we engage with municipalities.
Thank you. I think we covered 117, bursary grants, 118, and 119. That brings us to the end of provincial treasury. Before we go over to the Western Cape Gambling and Racing Board, any closing comments, Minister?
Thank you, Chairperson, for this opportunity to appear before the Standing Committee. I will now excuse myself. I think we have got a new chairperson, and I think it might be a good opportunity for him to feel the heat of the committee. And I think it is Usela, sy eerste geboorte doop. As you, ek weet hy is Anglican, so hy het 'n klein doop, maar ons is nou, hy kan nou sy groot doop kry. So, Chairperson, thank you for this opportunity and thank you for these questions. We made substantive notes and we will certainly come back to those reports that were requested by the committee from the Treasury. And if I can be excused. Thank you.
Thank you. HOD?
Chairperson, just other than to say thank you to the committee for always keeping us on our toes. I mean, it's actually important, this process, and we actually value and appreciate the questions. I mean, it does influence our thinking in terms of how we execute our decision making. So thank you very much to yourself and the committee, and also to the management team that's making all this work possible, as well as all the staff of the Provincial Treasury. Thanks.
Thank you, Minister. And HOD, from our side, we just want to thank Treasury in itself for the role you play in the government itself, affecting all departments and your preparation, guidance, quality and standard of work. We're proud of you, Minister and HOD. We're very proud of all the staff in Provincial Treasury. And thank you for your service and thank you for responding to the questions this morning. Thank you very much. Your excuse, and I'm sure only the Gambling Board officials will remain. For them. There's lunch, 1 o'clock for everyone present here in the members' lunch. Okay. Thank you, Minister. Thank you, HOD. Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome to the Western Cape Gambling and Racing Board, the officials and official treasury. I just would like to know for the record, which is done the introduction this morning, I was told some people around here, chairman of the board, or the new people that came in afterwards. I just want to make sure about that. Welcome to the leadership and the team. Thank you very much for attending, and I'm sure you're also going to have a full discussion like the previous one. I'll give you an opportunity to do your open remarks.
Thank you, Chair.
Just with regards to additional members, our additional board member has joined us, Ms. Chumafane. So, yeah, we are now four board members present. Yeah. Thanks for the opportunity also to myself and to members of the committee for this opportunity to appear before you and to present our 2018-19 budget as well as our annual performance plan. Just to highlight one or two, most of the items are in there. Risks that particularly face the gambling board in the year lying ahead. For us, the major risk is the composition of our board at this stage, and also with regards to our accommodation. Those are the two major challenges that will face the board. Any other matters, it's part of the program, and we can deal with it on a question and answer basis. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lacay. Okay, on behalf of our committee, I just also like to congratulate you on the responsibility, the appointment going forward, and wish you well in that also.
Thank you, Chair. Okay.
And also the new board member, Ms. Fani.
Thanks, Chair.
Welcome. Welcome to you as well. I just like to, on the opening remarks, I'm sure members want to ask questions, but the composition of the board, clarity on that, and then I'm sure, I don't know if the minister is not here now, but he's got the responsibility for the office accommodation. I'm not sure who on Treasury is going to update us, otherwise we have to go back to the minister on his direct report or responsibility. Members, before there's a response, Member Ace?
Mr. Chairperson, I would also like to propose that you give the opportunity to members to raise the different issues in terms of the ATT, but not go page by page. I'm sure everybody listed their issues and just my 5 or 10 issues and then they respond to that. Yes, I thought the chairperson, also congratulations to him. He actually mentioned the risk, but I mean he must give answers to address that risk. And I mean that's maybe the first lesson to learn. You don't come here with your problems, come here with your solutions.
And then we ask a question on that, the two major risks, but I know the one is provincial treasury and the minister, and the other one is from their side, would like to have just a clear understanding of what it risk means. I think just on the opening remarks, we just cover it. Thank you.
Chair, yeah, of course, we don't make our problems anybody else's problems, we deal with it, but we thought we would just put it out there what we're dealing with at this point. If I may respond with regard to the composition of the board and why we specifically mentioned that, because if we are not quoted, we will not be able to deal with matters as expeditiously as we want to. And we are in the process of having the board reconstituted. Members will know that there has been an interview process, and that's the current where it is. At this stage, the board is not composed of all its members. The board composes of 7 members, and at this stage, we only have 6 members, and as you will know today, we only have 4 members present here today. One of our members is ill, has had an operation, so that is one part, and there's a vacancy in the board currently, and then one other member, through circumstances, is not able to attend. So that is really the issue that we are faced with. And until we have a full 7 board members, can one allow for absentees through illnesses, etc. And that's why we're highlighting that. But, as I mentioned, there is a process that is being handled by a provincial government as part of that process. But again, why we raise it is because it's something that we have been dealing with for some time and could impact on us until it is completely resolved. With regards to the accommodation, we are in the process with provincial government as well. And at this stage, in our budget, there is provision for us to rent buildings over the next number of years. That process is ongoing. It has to go through the whole advertising process, calling for tenders and that type of thing. So whilst it's being dealt with also, it has sometimes unintended consequences, which you can't just foresee. For instance, they can lead to bad morale of people working in confined spaces and old buildings, etc., that type of thing, which could impact your efficiency as again. So whilst we highlight the risk, we are fully in control of the risk to the extent that we as a board can. And as I've mentioned, yeah, both these issues is driven from external of the board itself. And we need to constantly engage to ensure that the process will be able to be resolved without negatively impact on our full deliverance of our EP. Thank you.
Thank you. I just would like to know if Provincial Treasury has an maybe here is the principle of the matter, if they have from their side any comment and accommodation. Any update on the report, a progress report?
I came in at the end, but I mean, I know the context. This discussion around accommodation have been going on for long. In fact, we refer the matter to the Department of Transport and Public Works. I can also report that we've made progress. We met with the CEO last week to give him an update. In fact, as part of the budget for 2018-2019, we have now provided additional funding in the budget to deal with the accommodation constraints of the board, on provisor that obviously they follow the required supply chain processes through the Department of Transport and Public Works. The Gambling Board have already provided the norms, so it's about 1,900 or so square meters of accommodation that they required, plus parking. In fact, as late as last week, we received an updated letter where they've asked that certain categories of staff in the Gambling Board be placed in cordoned off offices, if I can put it that way. We have supplied the Department of Transport and Public Works with our recommendation on it. It's not going to extend the square meter is required. The Department of Transport and Public Works has indicated that I think they're going to put out an advert in the paper over the next 2 weeks or so. The Gambling Board has also provided us information on the preferred residence, if I can call it that, and that we provided through. So hopefully within the next 2 to 3 weeks, the ad should be out. The Gambling Board have also asked to be part of, obviously, the evaluation processes. Transport Public Works just need to check the supply chain regulations on that. But the commitment is that we do this together. And until we find a permanent solution, the temporary solution is actually to find rental accommodation in the area of Zetland. So that's where we are with it, but I think the key step is that funding has now been provided in their budget for a temporary solution, with obviously the permanent solution of building a dedicated premises for the Gambling Board probably over the next 3 to 5 years.
Thank you for Provincial Treasury for the feedback, the progress report, and I think it's a good one. At least there's progress. We're going to go over, member, to the normal questions that members want to ask, or do you want to follow up on this accommodation? Okay.
No, Chairperson, yes, thanks for that report. I think there's progress. And by the next round, I'm sure we're going to understand what's happening and that they're moving, and that's great. Can even be a permanent arrangement. I still don't see why we must buy buildings. But anyway, see it as a permanent one, that you're going to stay there for a while. So don't just think, we can take any rental accommodation and then we're going to move very soon. Rather have that perspective of this is going to be our new home. Chairperson, but just on the board and the composition. Composition's fine, but the members of the board, and we had that problem already, and I think the Treasury will have to guide us at the next meeting. What do we do with people who don't attend on a regular basis? I've asked that question previously, and I can say it here again. It's open. It might be more people, but there was one person, a deputy chairperson, was also a member of another board in another province. And that was an obstacle, if I can call it that, in terms of the proper functioning of this board. And maybe we will have to get some direction and from Treasury and yourselves on how do we deal with that. I mean, we have a process indeed to appoint a person, but we don't really have a process of asking that individual, listen, you do a good job, but I mean you're not available, so we will have to also look at that. We can't sit every single day or month or second month to appoint people. I mean, it take all your time just to appoint one member of the board. And maybe there's a need, and I think there's a need to look at the regulations in terms of appointing board members. There's no reason when we have a short list of three people why only number one must go through, but when there's a vacancy, you must start the whole process. Why can't number two and three ask, are you available, move in and do that? So please, can we also get a report on amendment to the regulations, please?
Good member, thank you very much. Okay. Well, that's your point you made earlier, member. I think we've done, we've done something to that effect with the last appointment. Member, it's over to you now to continue asking the questions to the board, member.
I've got a couple of questions. The first one is one thing that we asked you to become financially self-sufficient. And we don't address it really in the APP, and I would like you to comment on that and the progress and what you're really going to do in this financial year coming to be self-sufficient. So that's the one. The other one is illegal gambling remains a problem and a major challenge, and I want to ask how you're going to strengthen it on your side to really stop illegal gambling. I think it's been neglected and we must attend to that. Thirdly, Chairperson, it's the amendments to the law. I think the NEC announced this in his budget speech. There's going to be a whole process of amendment of the law in terms of a proposal made by the board. Maybe they can help me here. And this morning we heard about amendment to the regulations as well. So maybe it was meant the same thing, or is there amendment to the law that's coming to the fore and the regulations? We heard this morning the regulations will really help them to get additional income in terms of services rendered to clients. So can we just understand the governance or the legal framework and how we're moving forward in terms of that? I also would like to understand if there's any vacancies and when those vacancies will be filled, and any progress with the compulsory player card process. Do you still believe that's necessary? If you've done your homework, when will that be concluded? And then last two, Chairperson, is the automation of the licensing applications. Every year that's in the APP, and every year it seems like there's no progress. And the one says IT, and the other one might say something different, but I believe it's IT holding us back here. Maybe they can tell me I'm wrong. But please, sir, why do you come with that every time? Have you heard how not difficult, but really labor-intensive it is to look at all this stuff on a manual basis? And then lastly, Chairperson, the issue around water and the crisis and the problems, and not only at your own residence as the board, but have you started to address this in terms of the different role players out there, the casinos, those that got a license? Because if there's a problem out there and you don't help and support and be proactive, you're not going to get that 500 million rand, or what was the amount or plus that you got in for taxes, if I can call it that, in. So we'll have to protect what's happening out there, and what part is the water and the sustainability around that. And just to understand, what did you do as board to help keep the money flow sustainable by keeping the businesses generating their tax for government sustainable? Thank you.
Thank you. Member Bevanko, do you want to ask? We just want to ask one or two rounds of questions.
I must not determine which is the more important one, because there's quite a few. Chair, maybe I must start on page 17. The board, in order to create public awareness of the board's functions and the negative effects of problem gambling, have entered into partnership with various organizations, and there's a list of few there. My question on that is, who's taking the lead in these programs? Are they piggybacking on the programs of those partners, or are they leading the process? Because if you look at
further on when they start talking about their targets, they only talk about, you know, their programs. There's only four awareness programs, yet they've got so many partners. So it doesn't just, who's leading it and why is it only four, which means it's one per quarter. And on that same page, PSG 2 says, to improve education outcomes. How does the gambling board do that? And enable a resilient, sustainable quality and inclusive living environment. I know these are PSGs of the whole of the province, but how does the gambling board play a meaningful role in that, as well as the next one, embed good governance and integrated service through partnerships and spatial alignment? How do you fit into that? And then, does it help that I ask questions about the legal, because I don't see the legal advisor here?
Mission Chair, the professional assistant, Ms. Hartman.
Oh, okay. Should I ask? Okay. Where is it now? Quickly, on what page is it where you unpack all your legal cases? Relevant court rulings. Now, it's all very well to tell us about that, but you're not saying who initiated it. Is it, you know, a Akani, a Garden Route versus that? It's not clear about who initiated what and why was this there. The same with the next one, and the next one, and then this one, Tamani, is it, or T-Main, is it T-Main or Tamani, I don't know. Versus the chairperson of the Northern Cape Gambling Board. What does that mean to us? What are we supposed to take from that? Then on page 16, performance environment, two licensed LPM route operators, and then 620 licensed premises, 412 LPM premises. Just connect those two for me. The LPM route operators and the LPM premises. How do they connect each other? On page 19, continued development, I'm looking at those bullet points, eh? Continued development of a talent pipeline by doing what? Promote cultural diversity, annual cultural events. When and where are these held? I've never heard of them. Or maybe they were, but you didn't tell us. We've got the answer about the foundation. Number on page 27, number of board meetings at which resolutions are adopted and license applications are considered. Across the years, you've only had 11. Now you're deciding that it's going to be 13. How do you know? What determines the fact that you can now say you're going to have 13 meetings? And I already asked a question on page 30. You know, this issue of legal opinions that you think are going to be drafted, one would like that to decrease as opposed to increasing. But even there, is that a thumbs up that you know how many opinions you'll be drafting, or are you just basing it on what's happened before? Well, let me stop there, Chair.
Thank you for the questions. I just want to say two things before the officials respond. I wrote a letter to the Gambling and Racing Board about their role in terms of avoiding the zero. But I think what I've probably missed out is the facilities that you also link with, particularly the one in Cape Town. So I think that question can respond to that. And then on the illegal gambling point that Member A has raised, I think we also would like to hear I think it's a national training that you had in mind or went through. Just an update on that as well. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair and members, for those questions. If I just need to deal with it, I'm just firstly going to allocate who's going to be responsible. It's your first question on financially self-sufficient. I'll ask our CEO to respond after I've just given an introduction. On illegal gambling, our compliance manager will do that. Amendments to legislation and regulations, our legal assistant, Ms. Hartman. On the vacancies, Mr. Bowers will please respond to that. On the compulsory player part, Ms. Hartman, again, will respond to that, and I will add to it as well. On the automation of the licensing process, our ICT manager will respond more fully to that. Then on the water crisis, I'll just give you some time. At our own premises, we are obviously doing what everybody else is doing in terms of the water saving, the reductions in the water use with recycling of grey water and all of that matters. I think our offices may not be the big issue, but the big one would be at all our licenses premises. And it is very good news to indicate that all of the major casinos have started or have implemented already water saving processes. And recently it was in the media, the big project that Culloden Casino had launched. They had implemented a water purification system at the casino where the water from the spa and from the casino is being purified, and that water is then pumped through into the community for the community to use. So they have spent 400 million rand on this whole project and assisting the municipality in that region. And that amount may just be, but it was a substantial amount that they had spent implementing, bringing the water purification plant and everything into use in assisting the municipality. Grand West, we know a similar, has over the years already had water purification. All of the grants, and Grand West is also providing the municipalities in the region and other users with grey water that has been purified. Booster is also implementing a water purification process, and the Sorgesan casinos are also looking at implementing and in fact also installing desalination plants to come to off the grid to the extent that it is possible. So we are aware, some have already implemented and others have budgeted substantial amounts of money with regards to the water purification processes and reduce their water use, not just for this crisis, but on an ongoing basis. Part of the process of the committees that deal with these licensed premises is to go and inspect these sites. At Culloden Casino, we were shown the water purification site. When we go and have our committee meetings at the other sites, we will be doing exactly the same. I think I just omitted to mention also that Garden Route Casino have also just commenced looking at a water purification plant in the Marshall Bay region. That's the water. If we can just please answer Asa's questions, and we'll come back to Member Bien Van Gogh's questions. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. On the financial self-sustainability, we had done an exercise already and we had presented it to Provincial Treasury. There are further engagements during this financial year to look at what it means that we can actually become less dependent on Provincial Treasury to provide us with finance. And those items are, in fact, to see where the industry can in fact increase their contributions to the board via the fees. So exercise is continuing right now. At the moment there's obviously some legislation out, the increase in the normal fees, that is normal CPI increases, and then some other increases which has just been published now recently and going through the process by Treasury. to provide the board with some new type of fees to become self-sustainable. So that's currently the process, but definitely in the new year, we will engage with Treasury to be able to increase the our review of our fees and then to increase it. So that's currently underway, sir. Okay.
Thank you, Chief.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think we would like to deal with the follow-ups while we deal with the issues, and we don't have to come back. So, sorry for the intervening, but Mayor Ricardo wants to do a follow-up.
Yes, sir, I just want to get an indication on the timeline on this self-sufficient review. What are we looking at?
So, the current process with the legislation of the Elisa Change of the Act has just gone out now. And then there's feedback back to province, and then province has to put into legislature, and then back again. So that's going to be a bit of a while, I think. I'm not exactly sure. That probably PT will be best to answer that. Our timelines is now by June. We're supposed to have back with PT our further review on further increases, and then that will be another legislative process that has to go through. So this is a bit of a while.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Regarding illegal gambling, I think illegal gambling is something that's always going to be a challenge, not only for this province but nationally. But within the Western Cape, I think we're making good progress. It's not a case of us totally eradicating illegal gambling. But just to give you some perspective, during the course of last year, one of the route operators, which is license holders, obviously they have concerns about illegal gambling. Because the more illegal gambling you have, the less money there is people go to license places. So the board, to a certain extent, have a certain responsibility to ensure that illegal gambling establishments are closed down as soon as possible. This route operator made a list nationally of all the illegal establishments. When the list was circulated, basically to us, there was a number of about 150 known illegal establishments in the country, of which on that list there were two in the Western Cape. The one in the Western Cape we closed down was in Gansbaai. That was also Internet Cafe. We closed that on the night of the 20th of December. That case is still pending. The second one is another establishment running in the George area. We had just met basically in the week with the Brigadier on that matter, and that matter we hope to have that thing sorted out within the next month or so. The problem with internet cafes is why it's taking a bit longer than normal, because I think we've explained it before already, a computer by its very nature is not a legal gambling device. And these spaces are set up in such a manner that the minute you enter it, these devices that switch off the software onto the PC, which makes then we got no evidence there. So those things have to be planned in such a manner where they have to do the 252 undercover operations, and that's a process in itself. We are very much dependent upon the assistance from the relevant SAPS officials to do that. But we've established good relationships over the years, and even in our meeting that we had basically on Tuesday in George, we are not meeting with the station commanders, we're actually meeting with the cluster heads. And this cluster that we're dealing with is a brigadier. And when they give instructions, those type of things, you know, people have to follow that. It's because a lot of times we were having situations where we would deal with the individual officers at the police station and they wouldn't prioritize those matters. But we are satisfied that we're establishing good relations with these people. What we've also been doing is through the awareness campaigns of the board is training, educating the communities in terms of not only responsible gambling, but what's constituted as illegal gambling. What the result is of what will happen from there is we'll get a lot of information coming to the office through the various telephone numbers to let us know exactly when people are identified illegal gambling as such. Then further to that is what we've also basically done is we've had sub visits with community police forums, particularly in the Wynberg area. While we might not be getting as much calls as we expected, we are aware that they know, they have our contact details, they send us information about crime statistics on a weekly basis. That is also to monitor any type of criminal activity relating close or around licensed establishments. For the initiatives that we got planned for the upcoming year is that we intend to have our own staff trained on in terms of downloading the information when we get to the internet cafes, because at the moment we are very much dependent on cybercrime, who at times they have about five guys at cybercrime that has to service the entire Western Cape. We've been told their priority, unfortunately, at this point in time is child pornography, and we basically have to wait in line before we get assistance. There is a company based in Joburg, and they've been helping other boards in terms of the, when they're on scene to download the information on that. But they are going to provide us training in the, we were hoping to do it before the end of this year, but it will be have to be basically in the new year. So with the result of that, we're going to get our own staff who's going to be certified to download the information. Now, the certification is very important because if our intention is to take this matter to court, is obviously the author or the authority of those that person to talk about why it constitutes what the software and those type of things. Those things will come basically into question. But as it stands, like I said, is I think we have two successful it was plea agreements, but we still call it successful prosecutions in terms of internet cafes. The third one is pending, and the fourth one is basically we intend closing that very soon. The other type of illegal gambling that we're still having basically is the 1 or 2 slot machines basically that you're going to have in your shops. That is apparently always going to be happening. We have a number of cases that we are looking at the moment. The unfortunate thing is some of these places are in areas such as in areas in Mitchell's Plain and in Delft, which is basically in the crime hotspots. Now, as a result of that, is at many times we obviously have to wait on SAPS officials to assist us. What is also happening is many times they all got raids on drug prices and they find the machines and they will let us know about that. But by that time already, obviously, they confiscated the machines. But the addresses that we've basically identified that they got to assist us, sometimes we just got to wait when they have operation in that area. But I do believe we're making good progress on that. Is one of our basically our in terms of our performance indicators is that the board obviously has to investigate all allegations of illegal gambling within 30 days. Now, while we do that within a week, we say 30 days because some of these places could be anywhere in the Western Cape. We've got to serve, we've got to go as far as Knysna, Frederick, and all those places. And we basically, to a large extent, we're basically meeting and exceeding that target. The other type of illegal gambling that, well, it's not really illegal gambling that we've noticed previously was, you would get these claw machines in these shops also where you, the claw machines where we'll take dolls and stuff. Now what some people have been doing is they've been placing money in there. Now the minute you place money in there, then obviously that basically becomes unlawful as such. In the past, what we've done is we've obviously approached the owner of the shop, then they would indicate that this one basically happened again. But what we've done in December this year, for the first time, we've actually confiscated the machine. The police indicated to us, you know what, they got the guy's name on the record as such, but it will just be a long outstanding case, and they didn't want to make a case against him, but the machine was forfeited to us. Now what we find with that is the minute you do something like that, the word spreads within the community. So to a large extent, we are hoping that those type of machines that's around is not going to happen. And in the last part that we're basically having, which we haven't had one in a long time, and that is poker sessions. Now the poker sessions are sessions basically, usually it will be a group of professional people that is in a closed venue. The difficulty in trying to close that down is because they have only members only, and unless we can infiltrate that those members and get one of them to provide the information, it's not that easy to enter. But those are what we have. In the Western Cape at the moment.
But well done, I think, to what you have achieved. I think it's a very important component that we've heard. It's very important. Thank you. Over to you.
Ms. Hartman, can you deal with the legislative regulations amendments, please, and also the player automation, player cards?
I'm not sure whether there was any specific thing that you were referring to regarding the amendments that you picked up maybe in the APP that can maybe guide me. But what I can update you about is there has been amendments to the regulations that have been in process for quite a while. We're actually looking at basically having the whole set of current regulations repealed and then kind of just rewriting it just for easy read. And then there's certain things that we're including in that regulations as well. We are currently discussing that with the legal services and together with the assistance of Provincial Treasury. In the past year, there have been amended regulations that has been published with regards to the increase in various license and investigation fees. That has also subsequently been amended as the annual increases takes place. There are regulations pertaining to the alignment of how our act and the regulations reads together with the audit in relation to audited financial statements that we are still discussing with Provincial Treasurer and Legal Services. And quite a few other regulations as well, but I'm hoping that within the next year we will be able to attend to the rewrite of the regulations. Then with the amendments to the law, as recent as the 28th of February, the draft 19th amendment bill has been published. That deals with, the bill was basically published and mainly deals with the reallocation of casinos. The two cases that popped up and the requests of casinos that requesting for relocations of certain of the casinos to the Cape Metropole. The draft 19th amendment bill then speaks to mainly the relocation of the casinos. A section has been included to address that so that it's made possible for the relocations to take place. And then also semantic changes with regards to license applications and the fact that you can also now apply for amendments to the license. The Act also covers the fact that there are fees that have been included into the bill to cover the issue of the relocation as well as the sustainability of the board. So there's a casino operator fee that has been included as well as an economic opportunity fee. That will be extra tax. I think the one will be an extra tax that's going to be payable, and then the one will be also a new fee that will be payable to the board in order to for the board to become more self-sustaining. I think we're going to one of our objectives is also for this new financial year to review the Act. I think in doing so, there's going to be a bit of changes that we need to do in order to align the Act with certain of the regulations that needs to be attended to and that we are currently still looking at. So, yeah, hopefully the overall of the regulations will be done in the next year. Oh, and... Is there a question? Okay, and then with regards to the player cards, we are currently still in the process and almost at the final stage of researching the player cards and the idea of implementing a player card within the Western Cape. We are still looking at the various factors. Obviously, the research that we're doing is desktop research, where we're looking into the various other international jurisdictions that has implemented player cards into their systems. There are pros and cons with regards to the implementation of the card. There are various legalities a person has to look at, personal information aspects that needs to be considered. So we are taking into consideration all of that. The draft report is soon to be finalized and then will be likely reviewed and tuned up within the next financial year. And in the period 2019-2020, we are aiming to disseminate the report and then also have stakeholder engagements with regards to the implementation of that.
And that's the law. May I ask, and maybe Provincial Treasury can help you as well, where do we stand with that? Was that approved by Cabinet and it's now out for comment? What is the status of that amendment to the law itself?
The 19th Amendment Bill was published on the 28th of February for comment. And that is exactly the bill that speaks to the relocation of casinos and then the additional fees that has been...
Before you respond, Treasurer, I wanted to ask also, is there no public hearings required for this?
No, I understand the question of members. It's a first round bill that's been published for public comment by the department.
So it's gone through the cabinet processes. I mean, we've been busy for it now for the last while. So I think the commentary runs for 6 weeks. And after 6 weeks, obviously, we will get the comments and then take the comments into account. After which, we'll go back to cabinet as the process is. And then, you know, if we decide to proceed or if cabinet decides to proceed, then the minister will obviously introduce it into the legislature. And then we go through a formal public comment process from the legislature's perspective.
Just follow up on that. When this information became public or some time ago, there was statements or question about legal challenges between stakeholders in the casino industry. What has happened to that, and is that, does it impact on the process we started now, or is it separate?
Yeah, those processes are separate processes. I mean, we have been cited in some of those things, but legal services are dealing with the matter, obviously, on behalf of Treasury, and also, you know, Gambling Board has also been cited in some of that stuff, but that's an entirely separate process. So once we get comment set, you know, through this commentary process, we will then, you know, go back to cabinet, and then if the bill gets introduced in the legislature, then obviously we'll bring it as part of this process.
Thank you. I'm just sorry, Mr. Lady, I've cut you off. Is there anything you wanted to add that you wanted to add?
No, sir.
You're covered. Now, thank you. Other points, you can continue.
Chair, the next point, the question was with...
There was vacancies. Was what? The four vacancies that we had as at the date of printing, we've now left with two since then. So we have two vacancies currently at the board. One is being re-advertised because we couldn't find a candidate during the first round, and the second one is a new post that we're advertising for the first time. So both within the next few weeks, we're completing the supply chain process to place an advert.
Question, what is your method of advertising? What do you use, papers?
We use newspapers. We also put on our website, sir, and we do the shortlisting ourselves internally. We don't make use of external parties.
Automation.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ait. Yes, I agree with Mr. Ait. It's been a while that this specific topic is always on the table. I think last year was the first time it was budgeted for. Unfortunately, in the 2017-18 budget, because of budget constraints, we were forced to take that budget off, and we couldn't go ahead in terms of engaging or tender for anything in terms of automation. However, that didn't stop IT in itself. Myself engaged with the industry, and I've developed a roadmap in terms of for this automation and how long it's going to take. It's basically going to take, we've put down basically around about 24 to 36 months looking ahead, but we are now in the process of actually developing the BRS, the business requirement specification or terms of reference for advertising either the end of this month or soon in first week in April for specifically for the automation of the license project. We've developed it in terms of the roadmap to be a two-phase approach type of thing. The first approach would be to task the casinos at first, because they are the biggest in terms of all of the applications that is on the website with the download. We want to digitize all of those things and put in workflows, as well as ensuring in terms of feedback and redevelopment of the website to tend to cater for the portal as well. So there's going to be a very intense process, because it's going to involve not just ourselves, but it's also going to involve the industry as well in terms of that engagement with them, as well as the IT side, as well as the business. So I'm very excited about the project that we finally can start with it. Thank you very much.
What is the total cost for this project, and when will it go live?
The total cost for the project, we've estimated to be between 7.5 million to 8 million. Go live, because it's in phases, we're looking at first targeting the casinos, so hopefully we will be going live within the first year, by the end of the year. Starting the second year, we'll be going live with the casinos only. And then from there we will task all of the others, which is the bookmakers, the other two operators, RPM operators, as well as the totalized data.
Fine, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We will continue with the member Bevankel. Some questions. The first one, the board awareness, and who's taking the lead. I'll ask the CEO to respond to that. And then also, if the CEO then can immediately also respond to the number of meetings, and I will add to that if necessary. And then the question, how does the gambling board improve education? I will respond to member Bevankel. And the legal cases, Ms. Hartman can give us some information on that. And then I'll ask Mrs. Basson to talk to us about the route operators and the licensed premises. That's it. And the legal opinions and Ms. Hartman as well. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Bauer is actually the manager responsible for our awareness, and so he'll talk to the awareness programs. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. The awareness programs that we've embarked on for this year, the launch occurred last week, Monday, in the Breda municipality. We are targeting all schools in the greater metropole. We started outside the city of Cape Town, and we're moving our way in. And we've driven this in partnership with the other service. Actually, the board's program. We're getting on other partners like education to give us permission to the schools, to the high schools. And then the decision was to target grades 8 and 9, being the youngsters that come into high school before they get into the exposure, to inform them of what illegal gambling is and the fact that they are not allowed to gamble, and also to advise them that if they become aware of it, to channel that information through the principals. So we now get a pipeline through the principals to supply information to us that they might become aware of. We did four schools last year as part of the pilot project. The board leads the programs. Social development would be given a section to give information to school kids on assistance that they provide. South African Police Service is there as well, and they have a section to give to the kids. And then we have speakers, usually from the community, that would share with the kids their experiences, their lived experiences in addiction, because obviously gambling can lead to addiction, so we try and tie that into it as well. We've put it down as four per year because we're looking at we're counting a specific area that the Western Cape Education Department gives us. So we, even though we might do four schools, that is seen as one program. So that's why we're reporting it. We will actually be doing 12 schools per year, but we're doing a region, so we're counting a region and not the individual schools.
Mr. Bowers, would you continue with the improvement in the talent pipeline as well?
The talent pipeline, the improvement in the talent pipeline is where the board in its new online system with staff, the staff development plans, succession plans, is all online. So the staff is developed in terms of growing within the board and also growing within their current position. So that talent pipeline that's being referred to here is taking staff and moving them through through the organization and developing in that sense.
The relevant case law that we set out on page 12 and 13, I think it's more an indication or like just background given pertaining to the history of case law, and just an indication that there has been cases that has had an impact on the gambling industry in the past. So it's more just for information purposes that it is set out in the APP. But like for instance, with the one case, the one of the most recent one, I think the last one that is set out here, the Team Main Flamingo Casino, it has been listed specifically because of the current litigation that we are facing with regards to the free play credits this is also a similar matter where the relevant casino has challenged the Northern Cape Gambling Board with regards to the calculation of the gross gaming revenue of the relevant casino, and the fact that the free play credits that they offer their punters should not be taken into consideration in respect of the calculation of this gross gaming revenue. So it's been a recent case. It's something that we are currently also facing at our board. So it also has been set out there for information. The number of legal opinions, page 31, I think. Sorry, Member Bierwinkel,
how do you get the result?
Why has it decreased?
I would like it to decrease.
Yes.
But how do you determine that you are going to have around about what you eat per year? Are you basing it on what happened? That's what I would do. That would be a nice round figure or something.
It's estimated in line with what we have previously been faced with, and it does decrease because matters that you have researched and advised on won't necessarily pop up again. So it does decrease, but it's an estimation just based on previous statistics.
I would just like to add, Jane, from Ms. Bierwinkel's information, also you know, man, that we are in a very litigious industry, and these people will challenge anything. As currently they are challenging, why is the board setting conditions in terms of BBBEE? We are required to monitor compliance with the BBBEE Act, but people will challenge you for the smallest thing because it may have an impact on their operations as well.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just answer the question with regards to the connect between the route operator LPM versus LPM premises. In the Western Cape, we do not license independent sites, LPM sites. All LPM premises need to be associated to a route operator. So in the province, we have two license holders, two route operators, being Vukani Gaming and Grand Gaming, and they are licensed to roll out a network of machines, and they then find suitable LPM premises that we will then license independently.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Chair. The board generally has one board meeting every month, except for December, so that would be normally 11 meetings. But generally, every year the board does meet to discuss firstly the APP and the budget, so it becomes another board meeting which is added. And then with the financial statements or the final financial statements, they also meet to discuss those. So those have regularly been held, and we always went over our 11 meetings, and so we decided to include it as special meetings to make the 13th of those two meetings.
And then with regards to how does the gambling board contribute to improve education outcomes, through the CSI programs that our license holders have, we request that they, through their programs, support education. And for the last few years, the gambling board has engaged extensively with all the license holders, particularly to direct their CSI spending into particular areas, and we've asked them to make it in fact two particular areas. One is education and one is job creation. And with regards to education, we've gone even deeper and say that we want education to be right from the early childhood level right through to tertiary level. And by participating in our committee meetings, they report quarterly on the programs that they are undertaking and how these are progressing. Therefore, the board plays almost a direct role in ensuring that the CSI money is going into education, the outcomes of that education is continuously improved, and it delivers the desired results. so much that we can say that all of our license holders, the major five casinos, have contributed extensively to tertiary education. Grand West has its own graduate program, and during the 2016-2017 year, that program delivered 17 graduates, and it's ongoing. The Sohosan Group has called as what they call an Rules for Lives program, which teaches young children, I mean preschool children, to start playing chess, but it develops their whole process of being able to learn. So those things definitely contribute to the outcomes of the education. You can see the quality of individual that is produced is a direct result of those programs, ma'am.
Member Bivoga, you covered? You covered. Thank you very much. Anything else, members? We covered. Then I would like to thank Mr. Fay and your team for the responses to the questions. I'm sure we are more informed now, and as we go through the budget process and into the new financial year, we want to also wish you well to carry out your own vision and mission for yourself.
Thank you.